This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering only on Shudder this week is Cold Hell, an action-heavy thriller from Academy Award winner Stefan Ruzowitzki. When a female taxi driver witnesses a brutal murder by a serial killer, she is stalked by the killer in an attempt to silence her. Instead, she goes on the offensive. She avows to uncover his identity and kill him as the hunted becomes the hunter. Birth Movie's Death declared Cold Hell a smash-and-grab assault on the senses, leaving you out of breath and totally exhilarated. Cold Hell is now streaming only on Shudder. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
All right, Shockers, you want some official Shockwaves merchandise? You've got it. Head over right now to CavityColors.com. They're back in stock with Shockwaves t-shirts. We have the official logo shirt. We also have the Shocker with original artwork by Devin Whitehead, available as regular t-shirts and baseball tees. And there's also the Shockwaves enamel pin that comes with a little VHS backing. So head over to CavityColors.com right now and pick up your Shockwaves merchandise while supplies last. Okay, and welcome to episode number 88 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. How are you? What's the matter? Are you in the middle of drinking again?
I pulled away just because I knew you were coming. I was ready for you this time.
He knew you were going to say
it. It only took me a couple hundred episodes to get ready for this.
I know. Just about 200.
Yep,
Becca McKendry's with us as well. Hello.
What's up, guys?
Welcome. Oh, I like your t-shirt. She's wearing a...
Thank you.
It's Pinhead playing with the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
That's good.
Pretty clever.
This is a company... I only see them at horror conventions on the East Coast. I think they're out of Florida. It's called T-Shirt Bordello.
Oh.
And they have snazzy t-shirts, but I don't see them anywhere but like East Coast conventions.
There
T-shirt
you go.
Bordello.
East nice. Coast peeps. Also, Ryan Turek.
What's up, ghosts and goblins? How's everybody?
Snazzy, little phrasing.
He like worked
there.
On that in the mirror for like 2 weeks, and he was like pulling the trigger finger.
Oh, come on.
What up, ghouls and witches? Yeah.
Ghouls and ghosts?
Oh, man. Oh, boy. Where do we begin?
There's a lot to talk about.
I'm gonna begin with people picking on us.
In
particular, me.
Picking.
Well, yes, it was.
You're an elitist, man.
I'm an elitist, apparently.
And you're entitled.
It was, all right.
He was very nice in his delivery.
It was all in jest, but somebody took offense that I said, fuck you if you watch movies on your laptop.
I mean, admittedly, there were a lot of people that took offense.
A lot.
But
well,
there was one in particular who felt the need to write.
He sent me a really nice
email. Okay. Did we hear from lots of people on that? I didn't know that.
All right, do I really have to clarify this? Okay, first of all, number one, it's just my opinion. This is a free country. There's actually people in this room that don't agree with me.
I completely disagree with him on
this. Which is totally fine, because that's what a free country is all about.
I'm so with you.
That's number one. Yeah, Elric's with me, Becca's not. That's totally fine. Number two, I was specifically referencing people that review movies for a living. I just don't think, like, that's the point. The article was by somebody who is supposed to watch films in the appropriate environment to talk about them, and their opening sentence referenced that they watched it on Netflix on their net laptop. And I'm sorry, just as a film fan, I'm also old. I'm in my 40s, so that's not okay with me. That's just my opinion. That's my thought. I think if you're a film reviewer, you shouldn't do that. As far as me saying fuck you, I'm not taking that back at all. And as far as being elitist, like, dude, How much? You probably make more money than I do. I don't work for Blumhouse. I do a podcast for Blumhouse. I don't work for them. So I don't know how much money you think I'm pulling in putting out independent movies.
Yeah, I just think you have an uppity air about you, Rob. It's uppity. You know, you just seem
It took me 3 years to save up for the TV I have. Yeah. Like, so you bet your ass I'm going to watch every fucking thing I get on that TV because of how much it cost me. So I don't know what illusions you have about that we're famous or whatever.
Well, I was just going to say,
money.
We should just be clear who's actually on the Blumhouse payroll. That's me.
That's Brian.
That's right.
Brian is
Becca,
the one and
Elric,
only.
And Rob G are not on
but it's a very small amount.
Freelance.
You're on the Shockwave
payroll. We are Shockwave.
Right. Is a different story. Yeah.
No, but I completely.
Still be mean about Ghost Dimension. Yes. I can go to town.
You can.
I will say I completely disagree. And I am the type of person where I watch stuff on my laptop every day. Actually, it's not usually on my laptop, it's usually on my iPad because I'm working on my laptop and usually I have my iPad set up right next to it.
So you're only half paying attention to the movies
not
that you watch.
Not true.
That's also my point, which I think Elric agrees with, is it's hard. And I'm guilty of it too.
Because we do it when we're on our laptop. I think that's where it's coming from. I know when I'm watching, the things I'll watch on a laptop are things like YouTube, things that aren't available anywhere else. And I kind of hate watching it that way, but I know how much inattention I'm giving it, and that's frustrating. I don't care that you watch it that way, but I agree with you about if somebody is being paid to be like a Roger Ebert to direct humans to go to the movies, and they're like, yeah, I just watched the screening link of Annihilation on my computer. It's pretty dumb. I don't really like it. It's like, fuck. I agree. Fuck you, because that movie needed to be seen in a certain way because that's how it was made.
I make an attempt. If I got a screener link for something that I need to take a look at and I'm at home, what I'll attempt to do is use AirPlay to the Apple TV.
Yeah.
I just watch it on my TV, but I can't help it if sometimes that connection gets fucked up. So I do have to watch it on my.
But you also don't review the movies to direct the humans that have to go. I think this is a thing about like gatekeepers. If anything, I think what Rob's saying is actually kind of punk.
Do you not think that we are gatekeepers?
Yeah, we're more in the taste position. I can't stand that term, but we're certainly stray more into that because we're giving our taste, our opinion on things, and people are going. I think reviewers are actually paid professionals to give their review that actually helps direct people whether to go to that movie when it comes out. Also, we don't often cover the brand new movies. We're usually like weeks behind. That's how I know we're not that we're not gatekeepers because we're not organized well enough.
But that said, I understand the online screening mentality because, especially for reviewers, because even when we were still doing Blumhouse.com and Rob and I, well, we never reviewed on Blumhouse.com. So I'll even go back to like when I was reviewing for Fangoria or other sites. The amount of times I got invited to an actual physical screening versus the amount of times that somebody emailed me a screening link, it was like 9-1.
Yeah, no, I know. I know the reality from knowing people like you guys. Yeah. So I know it's not their fault. I don't know. From the filmmaker perspective, it's kind of depressing that somebody's watching it that way.
I'm weird about my phone. I will say I watched parts of the new Hellraiser movie on my phone, but I don't think anybody's going to fall. Rob's like, what the fuck?
It was practically night for that.
Because I had an hour. I'm waiting for my daughter at ballet class, and I'm suddenly like, I'll go ahead and start this. And I did. And I didn't regret watching it on my phone. Part of it. I watched about the first half on it, and then I finished the rest on the television once I got home. So then I watched it on the big screen. But yeah, I'm hesitant about my phone unless it's certain things. Like I actually, this past week, I watched an episode of the new Netflix show Frankenstein on my phone, and it's actually got some scope to it. So I want to rewatch that on the screen because I felt like I was missing chunks of it on my phone.
Should we reframe this to be like good movies should be on a screen?
I guess, yeah.
Sure. Movies are great on your laptop.
Well, if you have an iPad, I guess an iPad is a device that's for that.
Yeah.
You know, for because of the screen.
I don't know. I think as technology gets better and there's more technology in the palm of our hand and content is being made for just that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I feel differently when that's the case.
Yeah.
People, if they're making films for a phone,
I mean, the bottom line is it all boils down to your attention span.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like if you got to watch it on your laptop, fine. Are you being distracted by other things that are bombarding you while you watch that film? That's what I have a problem with. If you're too busy dicking around on Instagram while you're watching a movie or you're doing something else, then you're not giving that film or that filmmaker the time of day.
Because I can honestly say, even with a nice home setup, I pay less attention to things on Netflix, even if it's a good thing. I'm more likely to look at my phone, do other things than I will if I put in a Blu-ray disc and took the effort to do that, which I hardly ever do compared to watching things stream.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it's like, I feel like the psychology of how we buy into things now has totally changed.
Yeah.
And it's very bizarre.
Look, at the end of the day,
world, like you said.
Yeah. Or, at the end of the day, I really don't care how you watch movies, and you really shouldn't care how I watch them. Like, of all the things, I'm sorry if anyone was offended. Of 200 plus episodes of shit we've said on the show, and of all the horrible things going on in the world, is that really the thing that's bothering you? Like, I'm sorry, dude.
I do think, even though that you know, is clearly trivial, and even the guy who emailed us was clearly having fun with it, and was really good natured about it. I do think that it actually opens up an important discussion about how we proceed with media making, because there is the concept of trying to get people to go to the theater and continuing the scope, but then there is the idea if the mojo of people are watching it on iPads and their phones, how do you start crafting to that? Like, do you start catering the media for smaller screens, knowing that that's you the capacity?
Branded content and that has to be made directly for the screen sizes and the attention spans. That's why things like Crypt TV and those kind of things make sense, because they're directly aiming. I think when David Lynch goes, fucking your fucking iPhone, he's talking about, like, if you're watching Lawrence Arabia on a phone, you aren't watching
Dunkirk on the back on a plane on one of those small TVs.
That is definitely, like, there are certain things I would never watch on, like, I will always watch Channel Zero on my television because it is just so, like, it cinematic. Feels huge, and so I want to see everything that's going into it. Yeah, and Dunkirk's just silly. Why would you do that?
I saw that on a plane.
Oh, man, I don't think I'd want to be on a plane watching that.
It doesn't feel like a good
plane. I'd be scared
movie.
We're going Tom Hardy on there. No, thanks. Anyway, well, glad we got that out of the way. Your network rant.
Yes.
Great.
You're not an animal. You're a human being.
I'm a human. That is all.
That's
sorry.
Often, man. Sorry.
No. Well, I'm going to kick off with what I did this week before we dive into movies, just because the first thing I was going to talk about is not a movie. So I went to Disneyland yesterday,
guys. It was magical watching vicariously.
I know.
Your daughter enjoyed Disneyland for the first time.
Oh, my God. So she was just like insane. Like, she was out of her mind the entire time, where as soon as we get in the park, she's like, oh, my God, it's Mickey. And then she just lost it, and it just kept getting more and more elevated the entire day to squeals, just squeals when she sees Alice over there and things like that. But we ended up riding the Haunted Mansion ride 3 times, which was amazing.
Because it's the best thing.
It is the best thing.
And what's weird is we got, my daughter goes to Catholic school. Not because we're Catholic, but it's just a good school in the area. And so this morning we roll into school, and the priest comes up to Marnie first thing and asks, because he knew that she was going to be out yesterterday for her birthday to go to Disney World. And he was immediately like, so what was your favorite ride? And she goes, the Haunted Mansion. And he was like, mine too. And I was like, that's awesome.
I thought he was going to be like eternal damage in your soul.
Well, I felt bad because, like, I can't lie to a priest about why she's missing school, even though I'm not Catholic. I feel bad about that. So I couldn't say, like, she has a doctor's appointment. So I was just blatant.
Celebration of the afterlife.
Yeah, it's her birthday. We're going to Disneyland. But anyway, so I rode the Haunted Mansion ride 3 times, which gave me lots of time to contemplate just the lasting power of it and the characters in there. Like, people actually know the characters on the mansion ride, where you've got the Grim Grinning Ghost and the 3 hitchhikers and the bride. And I could not think of another ride like that, where it only exists as a theme park ride, but it is infused in the culture enough that it's kind of become iconic.
Mm-hmm.
Where
the characters, and an Eddie Murphy movie, right?
But even those characters weren't really in there.
I never saw it.
They kind of touched on it, but it wasn't submerged.
Well, Pirates, I think Pirates is similar. Pirates is scarier. It's a scarier ride. Like, for young people, I think it's the uncanny, because those things look so real.
Yeah.
My youngest, he couldn't do that, even though he could do the Haunted Mansion. When he did it, he was so freaked out by it.
Now, did you go
dark,
the other one that Marnie screamed on, and then she was like, I love it, I want to go it again, was Snow White's spooky... Snow White's Spooky Trip, or Snow White's Spooky Adventure, actually has a jump scare in it. There's this one where you see the witch, or you see the queen, and she's looking into a mirror, and then right as you're, it's like one of those little buggies, right as it gets close, the entire model spins really fast, and it's the witch, and she's pointing at you. And it was just amazing.
Well, what you're hitting on is childhood trauma, because of all the rides, it's actually The Wind in the Willows and Mr. Toad's ride that ends in freaking hell.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You're burning
in
hell, and then the ride
demon.
Ends.
Well, we did.
You're like, holy
We did
shit.
Disney over Christmas break, and Jackie and I had gotten Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
It's a crazy ride.
And she was like, oh, my God, that got really dark real fast. And I was like, yeah, that's what happened when you drink and drive, kids. So don't you dare fucking drink and drive.
Yeah.
That's a good call.
But I ended up buying the record because the soundtrack, The Grim Grinning Ghosts Come Out to Socialize, I absolutely loved it. So I bought the record
for
it.
Well, what's amazing about Haunted Mansion is that it has its own store now.
Yes.
Full of cool Haunted Mansion merch.
It was Haunted Mansion and Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yes, exactly. Because the two go hand in hand. But, you know, 10 years ago, I would go to Haunted Mansion and be like, oh, I want some merch. Now there's a whole fucking store of it.
Oh, my gosh.
So cool.
Yeah. So it was very, very cool. So I just had to comment on kind of the lasting power of it and how amazing it was to, you know, kind of explore.
That's sweet.
Wow.
So that's Disney.
Well, Ryan went to South by Southwest.
South by Southwest, man.
Give us the goods, man.
South I'm going to take my cans off the second he says Hereditary.
Oh, shush.
I know you don't want any spoilers.
I don't
want
to hear anything.
All right,
still.
So what do you guys want? What do you guys want to know?
Best films you saw there.
All right, the best films I saw there.
Horror films.
Well, first off, I want to say that Blumhouse was there for Unfriended Dark Web, which I'm one of the co-producers on, so it was very cool to be a part of that experience, to see a festival audience watch it for the first time instead of a test crowd, and they fucking ate it up. They loved it, and it's much, much darker than the first film. Then we had Upgrade by Lee Whannell, which is basically our first sci-fi action movie, and it's pretty badass. I had not seen it because Lee was working on it in post down the hall, and he'd just be like, see it with the crowd. I'm like, Lee, anytime you need notes, see it with the crowd. And then I finally saw it with the crowd and was just rewarded in many ways. It's very bloody, feels very 80s-esque. It's super cool. Beyond the Blumhouse plugs. So I saw a mixed bag of a lot of stuff, both comedies, dramas, and horror. I think my top two picks would have to be A Quiet Place and Hereditary.
Easy, done. Let's move on.
Listen, Quiet Place by John Krasinski, stars Krasinski and Emily Blunt. This movie is... It is a pure jump scare-a-thon monster movie. Pure monster movie. And I just love the fact that husband and wife just kind of got together to make a monster movie. And Krasinski came up ahead of, you know, before the screening, and he was like, I just want to thank my wife for saying yes to this.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
But it's very, very, very cool.
You know what it looks like? When I see the trailer, I keep thinking, oh, it looks like It Comes at Night, but with like payoff. Like, it looks like it'll give you the setup and payoff.
You know what? Yeah, it could be retitled It Comes at Night, because there are actually things that come at night.
Exactly.
But it's very well done. The creature effects are really well, you know, really effective, and the design is cool. But really, it boils down to Krasinski's kind of execution. This is a mostly silent film. A lot of the dialogue is played out through sign language and subtitles because the movie basically presents a world where something devastating happened to the planet, and these creatures exist, and any kind of noise, right? You know, a hushed whisper and above will set these things off and have them come tearing ass after you. Cool. And so everybody's got to be quiet. What Krasinski does well is set the tone of the world, the rules of the world. These people have to, you know, live in an environment and do very specific things. How do you eat when you can't make noise? How do you, you know, lay down? How do you prepare dinner? How do you prepare laundry? How do you do all of these day-to-day things that make so much noise? And he really gets into it. Although I will say that there's the water cooler lodge of some things about it, you know, I have questions, like, I have creative choices that were made that I question as well. But it's very, very effective, and I dare you not to cheer by the end of the movie. It is so well
done. I heard
done.
It was a big hit there.
Very well done.
It comes out April 6th.
Yeah.
That soon. Right,
it comes
cool.
out very
Great.
Soon, yeah. That opened up South by Southwest. And then Hereditary with Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne, holy bananas, guys.
So you've already given me one piece of information I didn't already know. All I know is Toni Collette's in it, it's a family, and there's a house in the poster. That's it. That's all I know.
And if you read the billing block of the poster, you would see Gabriel Byrne.
I closed my eyes, listen, your
methodology of things, I can't watch the trailer.
I'm so confused how you don't even want to know actors.
He's like, I'm not going to read the billing block of the poster. I don't want to know anything.
It's usually now, it's only like those one movies where you hear, oh, this is the movie, The Witch or whatever.
Listen. Everybody, you know, already seeing shit online, and people going, oh, it's already overhyped and blah, blah, blah. Listen,
of
man.
Of course.
You know what? It's a great horror movie that's coming out.
Cool.
And don't listen to anybody else. Just go see it. And then make up your own mind of whether it was like, you know, whether it was worth the hype or not. In my mind, it is, you know, where Quiet Place was kind of... It felt very machine-like, and it scares. It's a scare factory kind of movie. Whereas Hereditary is just pure dread.
Yeah, my favorite.
That will
movie.
Keep you awake. Like I was in bed, and I was like thinking about some of the images that they introduced me to, and I was deeply disturbed.
Is this somebody who had made a film before or first film?
He had done a series of shorts. Yeah, this is his first feature film. Okay. He had done a series of shorts, developed at A24, and made a really effective debut. I mean, like I told Becca that there's something that is very personal to her that will deeply unsettle her in the first 20 minutes.
Cool.
And I just feel like
which means I approach it head on and say, "Bring it, bitches."
All the performances are fantastic. The writing's really good. It is very much an art house horror movie, but this one actually delivers the goods. It keeps you thinking. It throws twists at you. It is very, very warped. And it's a little bit of a slow burn in the middle, but it picks up steam at the very end, and holy cow, man, it is...
Where is it going to fall in my top 10 of the year?
Unless Halloween makes you number one, which it should, then Hereditary will probably be number two.
Okay, so it's going to be high.
It'll be very high up. Right. It'll be very high up on my list, too. I mean, like, I am very, very anxious to see this film again and kind of dig into its many layers. It's very much a film about family grief and sickness. And at the core of that, that is already highly disturbing. And a lot of the themes that they're exploring, and Toni Collette gives an amazing performance. And then once you add this genre layer that will feel very familiar to horror fans, but it's done in a way that it works so beautifully in line with the family themes.
What's the date on that? Is there one?
Is
that summer?
It's sometime this summer, I think.
Okay, so we got a little way to wait.
Yeah.
More trailers I have to painfully sit through.
Man, it is.
June 8th, apparently.
Okay, yeah. And then really quick, a couple of other things that I saw. I saw Owen Edgerton's Bloodfest, which is, as he kept telling people, he's like, it's about Ryan. And he goes to a like horror camp out thing, but it turns out to be real. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can relate. It's a lot of fun. I found it to be very, very fun and highly reverent of the genre. And Owen himself is in it, playing this kind of, I saw someone tweet out, he plays like a Willy Wonka of horror, but he's like the mastermind of this kind of experiential horror thing that all these fans come out to. And then it kind of gets a little cabin in the woodsy, you know, very fun.
Nice.
I saw Ghost Stories.
I'm looking forward to that. We're going to see that in Chattanooga.
Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman. This one, I'm still processing. Okay. It's very anthology-like in its structure.
It looked like a series. It looked like a TV show.
Yeah, it's based on a stage play, apparently, a series of stage plays, but they blended them all together. I just got the new Room Org that covers this, so I want to see how this thing came about. But it's all it's three stories and then a wraparound, but they all tie together in some very dramatic way. I'm still processing. I don't know what to think of it yet because I see a lot of people talking about how scary it is, and it didn't affect me as greatly as it did, but I certainly appreciated a lot of the imagery that they threw in there and some of the bold narrative risks that they took. So I really like that.
Well, post Chattanooga, we could all discuss.
And I'm going to see if I can get another screening in just so I can watch it.
Did you see The Ranger?
The Ranger played the night I left.
Okay.
So I missed
that.
The
just looked like a throwback kind of 80s.
And I
love Jen Wexler. We've played multiple festivals together, and I always loved her shorts.
And then the other thing I saw that was kind of genre is called Perfect. By Eddie Alcazar, and this thing is just, it's not my speed. It's not, I mean, like, I ran into Sam Zimmerman. He was just like, did you see Perfect? I'm like, yeah, you know me. I'm not, this kind of like crazy abstract shit. And he goes, I loved it.
And
I
was like, which means Elric, because usually Elric and Sam. Like, yeah.
Quite a lot of the time.
Yeah, yeah. You guys
occasionally he'll go one step over where I would go.
Occasionally. It's mostly voiceover. The entire movie is mostly voiceover from different perspectives, but it's about this young man who kills his girlfriend and his mom puts him up in this kind of medical clinic to get help. But there's very abstract methods to making him better. And it gets very dreamlike and nightmarish. And I don't know, man. That just wasn't my thing. So
cool.
Yeah. That's Southwest.
Nice.
Yeah. I had one that tied into last week's episode.
Yeah. Hit us.
The Strangers, Pray at Night.
Ooh. Nice.
Saw that in the theater. And it was one of the first films in a while I've seen with like the real crowd those movies are intended for. Like it was like 10 o'clock at night on a Friday night and everyone there was under 17. I'd say entire packed audience except me and Dick. Right. We're just looking at each other like, all right, let's do this. I'm way mixed on this movie. There are things about this movie that I love. I love the zooms. I love the style. I love pretty much, and this isn't just because we had him on our show. I think he's doing a really good job directing this film. I think that's the fun part of this movie. I had so many... this one's really hard without being a spoiler kind of conversation because my issues with the film are all plot points and things that happen. I think it's one of my least favorite final girls of all time. I think totally undeserving, like one of those characters. You know, when you're watching a character become a character, I'm just sitting there going, I'd happily you to have died in the first 2 seconds of this movie. Like nothing there. But the Christine references are freaking rad. Like the way the film, like the kind of balls on it at times are really fun. That's the entertaining. It has a scene. My problem with it is, and it's always more frustrating, a great film or a bad film. What's sometimes most frustrating is a movie that does something almost perfectly and then blows it. And there's a sequence in here, like I was ready to turn to, and it's been referenced online, so I won't give it anything away, but there's a pool sequence where I literally felt like it was close to being my favorite sequence of the year. And I was like, this is so good. And then it ends that sequence in a way that is so wimpy to me and so narratively weak that I was like, like it literally hurt me as a film goer. And so it's like a fun, and so I felt like this movie had so many push and pulls in that way. And it also undoes a lot of things. You can't undo something from an original film. So I wouldn't say that, but it kind of messes with that, you know, not mythology, but characters and what happens to them in a way that at times I didn't love, but it was the perfect movie to see in a theater like this at night and have fun. So I'm way torn. Like I think on a style level, it's awesome. On some of the choices, I on the storytelling choice, maybe it's a script level. I found myself in pain at times, frustrated, like wanting to yell at the screen, no, don't write, don't show that, you know. But it was still better than not going. You know what I mean? Like it was still like, hey, when's the last time I got a slasher film? I was still feeling like, hey, this was fun.
Yeah, but I haven't seen it yet. I really want to because I like the first one, but everything I've heard about this is like kind of like it checks all my boxes. I think was it Brian Collins or somebody who's like it's like they cut right from Strangers to Strangers 7. And I'm like, that sounds cool to me. Like I kind of want to see part 7.
The problem is the two people in the first one are so well set up that even though they could be doing dislikable things, I like and root for them. I really did not like anyone except the son. I think he was really good. I didn't like them, and I found them kind of like it was almost like fingernails on a chalkboard. And when that's the setup, you're like it's a little forced, like their interactions with each other and stuff, so that might change, but it's still got some pretty awesome things. And I feel like he's channeling the one bad guy with the sack. And I feel like he's totally Decker in this. I feel like he's way more Nightbreed than anything else, which is kind of fun.
Did he ask if he had a gun?
I won't even go in. There's a lot of stuff in there that's
I'm very eager to see it again because I mean like I saw it with a preview crowd like a few nights before it opened and I had a blast with it, but I really want to see it again just now, like because I really like The Strangers, you know, as an original movie, but I also just I love my slasher movies.
Did you rewatch the first one before you saw the new one?
I did. I saw it the Monday before.
And is there much of a disconnect tonally?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
So they feel like
two different movies. And you'll get the people who either love the slow burn character drama, or you'll get the over the top, you know, just wild chase movie.
But they also do match. Like, I could tell that I could see them back to back going, oh, yeah, it's a world. They're just totally, they're different styles. The weirdest reaction I had, and this is something that we might be kind of like the opposite of what a lot of people, I've been reading a lot of people going, oh, it's so fun because it's not nihilistic like the original. Mm. I feel completely other way. I feel like the first one, because it takes its material seriously, is not nihilistic because, I mean, it's dark and bleak, but it's like, it's you actually are invested. I feel like it's actually nihilistic to make something where the world is total bullshit and you're just watching the violence. Yeah. And so I was, I'm kind of torn on that with it, but it's fun. I guarantee you'll have fun.
What were we saying about
it? Okay. I was going to say, like, the first one, though I appreciate it, it's not a fun film for me, and it's nothing that I would ever return to. And I can't say it's something that I enjoy. I just appreciate kind of what it did. But that said, the second one, when you say it's completely tonally different, now I'm like, okay, I'm back in.
It is fun. It moves. And they just keep doing fun stuff. I think he did a really... I had fun watching what he did with it. Mm-hmm. I think it's more story stuff. But again, we'll say we need to start making spoiler ones, man. We need to make, like, because there are so many things if we'd all seen this that I really would want to dig into. Yeah. Maybe it'll be a bonus.
Maybe we just, like, wrap each episode with, like, a little spoiler conversation after.
At the end,
yeah.
Turn it off once you hear the music, and then we just keep going.
We keep going.
Ernie's like, no.
We talked so long already.
No more work.
I gotta leave.
Let's see. I listen to something and I watch something. The thing I listen to, I think, Ryan, you got this too, and I was curious if you had a chance to spin it, but officially out today, the 16th, is the Saw Anthology vinyl set.
Yes. Yeah.
This is pretty crazy. I've always loved, I mean, Charlie Clouser is the composer on the Saw movies. He was a member of Nine Inch Nails during the Downward Spiral era, and it's one of those things where I can't remember in the last decade or so of horror where you'd recognize a piece of music more than Hello Zep, which is basically like, here comes the reveal.
Yeah.
And so this is the first time this has come out on vinyl from Lakeshore Records. It's pretty cool. It's a two-volume set. Each volume is two records each. And so each side is a Saw movie. Mm. So that means literally side A is Saw, Saw 2 is side B, and it's all eight movies sprawled over four LPs and two volume sets. It's a great set if you – I mean, you know, again, there's specific things that – it almost felt like – because I listened to it all in a row, it almost felt like a really condensed way to go through all the emotions of the Saw franchise without having to actually sit through all the torture and pain. because when I got to side C,
Did you listen to one and you're like, oh, the Darren Bousman ears?
Yeah, no, I did. I really – well, because Saw 3 in particular, I remember, had a lot of really good, like, melancholy piano stuff because that's the one with – what's his name? Agnes McFadden, whatever.
Yeah, Angus
and then, you know, he lost his kid, so it's a lot more deeply emotional. So, yeah, I immediately thought, like, oh, Bousman. It was the Bousman
that's
movie.
Amazing.
And so, yeah, so I thought it's – I mean, look, if you love – if you collect vinyl like we do and a lot of our listeners do at this point.
Did you get the Strangers 2, Stranger Season 2 record?
Strangers? Oh,
Stranger Things of Season 2.
Yes.
You did.
I have both the music and I have the songs.
The vinyl that came out through Lakeshore. I listened to it yesterday morning and I have to say, I don't know if you agree, but I think the soundtrack for Season 2 is immensely better than Season 1.
It's pretty good.
I think I just like, there's an evolved sound to it.
Yeah, the music's good.
Cool themes that I really like.
My one beef, which is actually silly, is that they don't include the theme song. Because they used it in part one, but it's almost like a thing. Like if you do multiple seasons as a soundtrack, you kind of always start out with the theme song again, you know. Like I don't know, but no, it is a great record set. Saw comes out today when you listen to this. It's available exclusively through FYE in the US and HMV in the UK.
Hmm.
And also, not really horror, but it was between The Strangers 2. Me and the guys got together last night. We went to Discount Theater, and it was between The Strangers 2. And Death Wish. And we saw Death Wish.
The new one.
No, the new one.
I totally forgot about that, Eli.
And we went to see the Eli Roth Death Wish.
I'm going to bet you chose wrong, but let's see.
Yeah.
We may have. Yeah. We may have chosen wrong. No, you know what? Look, because everyone, of course, immediately shit on it, the expectation was as low as it could possibly get. And I love the Death Wish movies. And let's be honest, the sequels in particular, like you can't get much crazier than three, and you can't get much worse than 4 and 5. Yeah. Although I appreciate all of them.
Or grosser than 2.
Or grosser than
2 is just
much,
the dirtiest,
much grosser
movie
than
ever,
2.
But,
this movie is, it's fine. But, but well, that's what I mean. Like,
I want that on the poster.
No, it's fine.
It's
just fine.
It needs an emoji next to it.
No, let me be more serious. Is it really possible to remake Death Wish? That's the thing. It's not because
had that vigilante a million times.
There's been a million vigilante movies, and so Eli Roth does a fine job directing it.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis is asleep at the wheel, except when he comes alive to do violence. Like, we literally were laughing out loud when he literally says lines like, "But I'm so excited." Like, literally, while half asleep, and you're like, "Come on, Bruce, why? You've got enough money, don't do it."
I really wonder if it was a directing choice, because I can't.
No, because we've heard from guests.
I don't want to believe that Bruce is that bad.
No, we've heard, and we won't say the name on the show.
It might have even been off record.
Off record, I'm saying, though, like, we won't say, but we've heard things that he doesn't try unless he's with directors.
He doesn't even care.
I remember that. Yeah.
Unless you kind of yell at him right off the bat.
Or he respects
you. Show that you're not afraid of him, apparently.
Like, if you're Wes Anderson and he's like excited to be in your film, he's going to bring his goods. Sure. And that's such a bummer.
Well, and so I mean, it's the traditional vigilante movie. Nothing really makes a Death Wish other than his name is Paul Kersey, which is, you know. But the other thing is he's a surgeon. He's like a surgeon in this. And
what?
It's literally, you know.
Jump the shark with the career choice, Bruce Willis.
Joe Carnahan wrote it.
Right.
And the only reason is because there's one scene where his knowledge of anatomy comes into play with torture. So it's like the only reason.
That feels like a studio note.
But if Carnahan had directed it, he would have cast something totally different.
Probably.
Keep in mind. The movie's gone through development hell for like a very long time. The big bad wolves.
The Israeli guys. Yep.
Yeah, and I see why they... Yeah. It's just like there's no good way to remake it. But that's because let me put it this way. What you remember about the originals, and especially in 2 and 3, is it gets so graphically horrific what happens and it doesn't go that far. Yeah. And that's the interesting thing to me is I think Eli, who I actually like most of his movies, not all, but I like the majority of his movies, but I think he is a diehard fan of exploitation movies, and yet he has this thing. He wants to make commercially accessible movies. Mm-hmm. And so you can make a cannibal movie, but you're not going to go as far as the cannibal movies by doing animal violence and you know what I mean? Like, it's still got a commercial level to it. You're not going to do the which they don't. And it's hard to say I'm disappointed because when the violent act that sets everything off, you don't want it to happen. You're like, oh God, I don't want.
Maybe they should have changed the setup.
That feels like a product of movies of the time.
Yeah,
like I think that if you put that into a film now, well, it's also the question of what is exploitation now versus what was exploitation when Death Wish came out.
Pretty different.
Because what we see as exploitation now is things like Cell Block 99,
I think Marvel movies are exploiting the modern era.
But I think that our definition of exploitation has changed significantly, and that would make kind of what Death Wish was at its core hard to recreate.
Well, and rape and violence on screen is an interesting thing because I had the same problem with Lovely Bones. What the problem with Lovely Bones is, if you read the book, it's utterly vile and disturbing what happens to them, and it like shakes you to your core as you read it.
And it's what drives the plot.
It's what drives the thing forward. And then if the movie comes out and it's more or less glossed over, you're like, well, what are the stakes now? It's same with Death Wish. That stuff is ugly, spit in your grave. These things are ugly, but if they're shown in a real and ugly way, well, that's real life, and it should be ugly, and it should be awful, and I should feel like Irreversible. I always tell people, like, the reason that's so good, even if you never want to watch it again, is because there's not a man on earth who could want to do something awful like that watching that, because it brings it home. And I think that's important if you're going to drive a whole narrative about a guy trying to get revenge. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you gloss over, it's like, oh yeah, she's probably attacking. You're just like, come on, man, you got to deliver that. It's tough. I know people don't want to watch it. I don't want to watch it. And part 2 especially is like really hard to watch, even though I like the way it's made, that movie.
Yeah. No, 3 is so over the top that it's like kind of fun, even though it's ridiculous
3,
where it goes.
3 definitely gets more comedic, dare I say it, with that. But
but it's still got the rape and violence.
It's got the punch to it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez, Becca.
But it does, but...
See, Disneyland changed you.
No. I mean, 3, I don't want to call it comedic, but it does have these notes where by this time they've done it twice, and so they can't keep you know, with the same violent. And so it does have this kind of more like self-aware, dare I say self-aware with a rape revenge film, but it does get there.
I mean,
there.
He does break
which
like
one's
a bazooka.
The crackdown? Four? No, three.
Four, four.
Oh, four is
no,
crackdown.
Three, yeah. No, I think, I mean, again, like my argument is I don't think this movie is, you could remake it anyway, yeah. because yeah. the thing that was so powerful about the original, I don't think this is really giving much away, but the thing that's so powerful about the original is Charles Bronson is getting revenge, but it's never against the people that actually committed the crime because mm-hmm. he doesn't know who they are and they never yeah. get caught. He's just going out and doing random acts of violence to kind of even the odds. Whereas this is by the numbers. That of course he's going to find out who's, you know, it just does yeah. the traditional. But that's the thing is, can you get away with that in today's movies? Would you be satisfied if Paul Kersey just decided to just go out there and, you know.
I think casting's a big part of it. Like, had that been Mark Ruffalo, like
yes.
a true everyman,
holy shit.
I bet you I would have been like, whoa, this is pretty cool. But with Bruce Willis, it's like, I already know what you're going to give me. Like, you've shown
yeah,
your
and you
hand
know what? His,
before it
his
even
brother
starts.
In the movie is Vincent D'Onofrio, and he steals the movie.
Oh,
he's
yeah,
like
yeah.
the best
D'Onofrio
part of the movie.
Cool, yeah.
And it's kind of like, kind of wish he was
yeah.
Paul Kersey, because
yeah.
that would
Hawk,
be a freaking
there's just
movie.
People who are like yeah. more normal.
That would be perfect for it. Yeah.
But I did
yeah,
find
absolutely.
Myself saying that once about Bronson. I was like, oh man, when they're casting Bruce Willis, an action star, man. I mean, I like everyman, like Charles Bronson. I'm like, wait a minute. Biggest action star ever. So it
so,
is
yeah.
tough. It's a tough one.
So it's all right, but it's, you know, it's
well,
fine.
Well, then I think
it's
Strangers
fine.
2 is probably better.
Okay.
I mean, I think you'll probably have more fun that
and I'll go see that next. Anything else, gang?
I'm going to talk about one super crazy one I saw, Tag. T-A-G.
Oh, yeah.
I'm excited.
Is,
you
yeah.
texted us in a fury.
I did. I was like,
texted
everyone.
Us at beyond my bedtime, Becca.
It was like, it was like 10:30.
She was very excited.
That's when Sion Sono movies exist.
I texted them and I was like, you guys need to go watch the first 15 minutes of this movie
I haven't
right
yet, but
now.
I
which popped up on Netflix. That's where you saw it.
Yes.
Right?
So this came to Netflix and I'd actually seen it on Netflix, but I hadn't paid much attention to it because the cover of it, it's a Japanese schoolgirl in full uniform kind of splattered with blood. And I felt like this isn't something I haven't seen before. So I had no idea that this was Sion Sono. So just judging by the Netflix little icon, I had passed over this for, I think it'd been there for a couple of weeks now that I'd been seeing it there. And someone, one of my friends, sent me a clip of the first 10 minutes and was like, you need to check this out. And the first, it was probably 15 minutes, the fucking craziest bullshit I have seen in a really long time. And I was like, oh my God, I have to watch this. So then I start the actual movie. And again, fucking crazy ass bullshit. And then where it goes is nowhere that I expected it to go. And what happens, like whatever you think is going on at any given point in the movie, it will go in a completely different direction that you never expected or in any way anticipated 5 minutes
did
later.
Did you like where the whole thing ended up going?
Yeah, I was going to say, did you like
not
the journey?
As much.
Exactly.
I yeah. did not like the ending as much, but the journey was fucking worth it because the journey was incredible. The last yeah. 10 minutes,
I feel
I was
like it loses steam after a while.
The last 10 minutes, I was like, oh, that's where we are.
Yeah.
But still, even with the ending that I'm just kind of like, meh, on the ending, you know, I wish because it had this incredible path to get there where I had no idea what was going on, but every single time it shifted gears, and it really does feel like seven different movies. Yeah. Every single time it shifted gears, I was like, I don't know where I am, but this is amazing now. And then it gets to the end and you're kind of like, oh, but
so everyone, let's watch
said.
The first 10 minutes.
What a review!
It's still no, it is so worth it. And then
this is actually probably the most excited I have seen you talk.
Yeah,
about
it was really fun.
Becca loves nuns and Japanese schoolgirls.
And okay. No, but it's not even.
Is
and
it
then
Thai?
Like it is Japanese. At least the filmmaker is Japanese. Yeah. But then
not
after,
since Gogo's Second Virgin have you been so excited
I
about
know.
Japanese schoolgirls?
What can I say? No, but this one, as soon as I was like, I think it was Elric that tweeted back or you. Texted me and was like, yeah, Sono films usually are nuts. Then I realized I've actually seen a ton of this guy's work. He did one of my absolute favorite ones, Strange Circus, which is another
yeah.
one where it shifted
one.
Gears. It's literally three stories. You're watching these three
Suicide Club.
Yes, he did Suicide Club. He did Noriko's Dinner Table. He did Cold Fish. But Strange Circus I've always loved because it follows the same kind of illogical, surrealist patterns where you're watching these three stories with the actors play different characters in each one of the stories. And you're trying to figure out which one's real or do they all three exist, but they're the same actors. So how do they all exist and how do they intersect? And I love that one too. It's again, really surrealist.
I'm definitely going to watch first 10 minutes. And if it grabs me, I'll
grab you.
Guys, he did Tokyo Tribe, the movie every single Shockwaves listener needs to watch. Tokyo Tribe.
I don't think I've seen Tokyo Tribe.
Oh my God. I saw this at Beyond Fest. It's basically the Warriors, but it's set in Tokyo and it follows all of these gangs and it's like a rap musical. So every gang represents different walks of like different basically eras of rap history. So you've got gangster rap, you've got the love and peace rap like De La Soul, you've got like all these, but they,
oh my God.
But it's about one gang that's got to get through Tokyo facing off against all of these rap tribes. It
guess
is
what gang?
It's amazing.
Tokyo Tribe is available on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
Dude,
on
to watch list. Watching it tonight.
Just made Becca's day.
Yeah. It is transcendent. I will just say that. I love this movie so much.
So everyone start with Tag. When your mind is completely blown, then go to Tokyo Tribe.
Pick yourself up with a little Tokyo Tribe.
Tokyo Tribe.
I saw an IFC Midnight new movie that I thought might be worth mentioning called Midnighters.
Mm.
First film by a guy called Julius Ramsey. I think he was a Walking Dead director or something.
Yes.
The only reason I watched it is because I'm a big Alex Esso fan, the actress. I think she's awesome. I thought the film was just a touch near. It's basically a couple. It starts on New Year's Eve, and she looks kind of sad and goes outside to talk to her boyfriend. They go home. They run over a guy, and they try, you know, take the body home because they're trying to deal with it. This is all the first few minutes, so it's kind of the setup. And then you realize, oh, maybe there's something else that they realize the guy was headed to their house. Mm. So there's some bigger thing. And so I was hoping for like a kind of a horror, spooky kind of thing because the way it's marketed, and it's definitely much more of a thriller and one that you feel like you've seen many times before.
Yeah.
More characters come in, a sister character, and it just keeps on going in the thing. So I can't highly recommend this one by any means, but it is. I think Alex Esso was really good in it again.
Yeah.
I think she's still stretching. It's nice to see her get, like, it has a lot of meat to what she gets to do in this. It's pretty violent. It definitely is dark. It just didn't really, it's not really my bag.
Yeah.
But if, you know, worth mentioning if somebody's looking for that kind of movie.
Cool. This is on VOD?
Yeah, that one I actually paid for.
Yeah.
It's like an IFC Midnight. I like to support the ones blindly. Occasionally, yeah.
You're not elitist and get everything for free.
No, I don't. It's believe it or not.
Oh my God!
I'm sorry.
I probably get the least free out of all of us.
Jesus. I will happily say that I've turned around on Silver Bullet.
Oh, good. Yeah, I think
excellent.
That's a fun movie.
I just ordered that umbrella.
Did you? Yeah,
Blu-ray.
I got the Blu-ray. And Silver Bullet was always one of those movies. I didn't see it at the theater. In fact, I distinctly remember my dad bringing me out to the cinema that night, and he pulled out the newspaper and he went, "Do you want to see Commando or do you want to see Silver Bullet?" And I said, man, that's a tough choice. But I was super young. I was like 9. And I think I said to him, I was like, I'm not in the mood for werewolves tonight. I want to see some Commando.
Wow.
And I mean,
Commando
is still the right choice. but I saw Silver Bullet on home video, and I wasn't impressed by it. I just, there was some tone to it that I didn't like. I thought it was almost too lighthearted because Cycle of the Werewolf was the very first book, Stephen King book I ever picked up. So I was a little disappointed by knowing where the source material came from. And we watched the Blu-ray, and it was like, okay, there's still some pleasant.
I think there's some creepy stuff. I think Everett McGill's weird, and Gary Busey's performance is weird. And
oh God, Gary Busey is on a completely different
unhinged.
Plane. The thing that really bogs it down is the awful werewolf design. I mean, like that werewolf design is just like when they show.
When I was young, I found it scary.
Yeah,
so I haven't
really?
Seen it. You haven't
oh,
seen
he's
it.
He's got those kind of
kid,
goofy eyes, and then they show him walking around, and you know we're used to like seeing werewolves. Yeah. With the kind of like the jointed legs, and this one's just walking around like he's got slippers on. He's just like, doo, doo,
I gotta watch. I haven't watched the Blu-ray
Ever
so it's
McGill.
Been a long time. Yeah, Ever McGill. That's why I won that round of trivia.
But what I love about it is just it captures that Stephen King Americana tone. You know, there's the girl that he likes, and then her dirtbag father, and you know, everybody's got stories. The one thing that Ciara and I were like, ooh, harsh, is when in the beginning the girl sees the woman having an argument with her boyfriend that she's clearly having an affair with, some guy she's having an affair with, and he's like, it's not my baby, you take care of it, I'm out. And we're like, ooh, shit, man. Cut to her in her bedroom alone, and she's like, suicides go to hell, especially when they're pregnant. And we're like, Jesus Christ, this guy's got fucking harsh.
That's dark.
And then a werewolf comes and kills her.
Oh, so she got out. Yeah. She got out easy.
She got out easy, yeah. But it's a really enjoyable Stephen King adaptation. I do really believe, maybe it's us, maybe it's not, maybe it's somebody else, but I really think we made a proper Cycle of the Werewolf adaptation.
Well, you know, Coscarelli, I think he talked about it when he was on, was supposed to do it, and they just didn't give a shit to get take Stephen King's advice on anything script-wise. I'm like, come on, it's Stephen King. But when I was doing my little column for the Blumhouse site, the hashtag respect, I wrote one for Uncle Red.
Oh, right. Yes, I
remember
that.
Like, I don't think he's acting. I'm pretty sure he is a raging alcoholic that is trying to take care of his kids. Like, what werewolf?
You know? Just riding
I love him because if you haven't noticed, midway through the movie, he shows up with a hat.
Yes.
And Dave, like, I remember we were watching it, and Dave had never seen it before, and he just all of a sudden goes, I'm going to wear this hat now. This is my hat. Because he wears it for the rest of the movie, and it's just like, what the fuck? Did he just midway through screening? And the script super, you can just see them like, okay, must keep hat on.
I like BC choices, man. Yeah, BC choices.
Well, yeah, BC is like uncle choices. He's like, I'm going to make a hot rod wheelchair for my kid, for this kid.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm a raging alcoholic.
It's pretty cool. Out of all the things that mom, you know, Corey's mom has an issue with, she's like, don't you get drunk in front of him. And he's like, oh, I'll do what I want. And then he makes this souped up wheelchair and the kid goes peeling off through town, passing cars, clearly going 75 miles an hour. And then it shows mom, and she's like, yeah. Mom's totally okay with a souped-up wheelchair. Then he's not wearing a fucking helmet.
Yeah, that's
anyways.
Well, I can't wait to monitor. We'll watch it. Let's watch Silver Bullet.
I'm down to rewatch.
I got three things to say super quick.
Holy shit.
I watched Veronica. It kicked ass. We can use it as our Shockwaves pick now.
Shockwaves approved.
Love Veronica.
Guys, I've reconsidered now.
Shut the fuck up, Kane. Graphic novel, Torso, my new bag. Yep. I absolutely loved it. If you have not read Torso yet, check it out. That was definitely my read
it's
of the week.
It's a good one, Brian Michael Bendis.
And I watched a Western called Shoot the Living, Pray for the Dead, which was recommended
Italian
to me.
Italian one?
Yeah, I'm going to name drop. It was recommended to me by Quentin Tarantino, who gave me a list of
article?
No, in person. I will tell the story because it's rather
amusing. Why isn't he on the show already then, Becca?
No, and this was
so
back.
Becca had her feet up.
You are so weird, dude. This is back when Kane and I used to be friends with someone who was dating Quentin.
Oh, yeah.
And
you mean a Rondo Award winner?
Yes, and we had gone over to Quentin's house multiple times to hang out with this person. And one of the times I went over, there was this stack of Western DVDs sitting on the kitchen counter. And I had actually said, what are these here for? And this is like Django had not come out yet. They were still in post. And they were like, watching these is kind of inspiration. You know, we've been checking them out. And so I actually snapped a picture with my phone then and have been slowly working my way back through. So Shoot the Living, Pray for the Dead is not on kind of the horror level that like Cutthroats 9 is. It's definitely more kind of slow burn tension-y. But that said, it was interesting. And the lead is Klaus Kinski, which is just amazing in a Western. Because, I mean, Klaus Kinski normally looks like he's about to chew on the set. In this, he looks like he's about to chew every actor's face off, like every single time he looks at him. So it was interesting.
So class, so, usually.
Quick like drop for Shoot the Living, Kinski Play for the Busey. Dead. Oh my God. That would be nutty. You get some Udo in there and it's just the craziest movie ever made.
All right, let's get our guests.
Let's do it.
Here we go.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering only on Shudder this week is Cold Hell, an action-heavy thriller from Academy Award winner Stefan Ruzowitzki. When a female taxi driver witnesses a brutal murder by a serial killer, she is stalked by the killer in an attempt to silence her. Instead, she goes on the offensive. She avows to uncover his identity and kill him as the hunted becomes the hunter. Birth Movie's Death declared Cold Hell a smash-and-grab assault on the senses, leaving you out of breath and totally exhilarated. Cold Hell is now streaming only on Shudder. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
All right, Shockers, you want some official Shockwaves merchandise? You've got it. Head over right now to CavityColors.com. They're back in stock with Shockwaves t-shirts. We have the official logo shirt. We also have the Shocker with original artwork by Devin Whitehead, available as regular t-shirts and baseball tees. And there's also the Shockwaves enamel pin that comes with a little VHS backing. So head over to CavityColors.com right now and pick up your Shockwaves merchandise while supplies last. Okay, and welcome back to the show. This is very exciting. We say that a lot. This is very exciting. But this is actually an idea that Elric had come up with a while back, the idea of bringing back one of our friends that's kind of an up-and-coming filmmaker, or a filmmaker now, and that we're pairing them with somebody that we respect that hasn't been on the show, that we can get a kind of a different insight into the filmmaking process from two different angles, especially since you guys are working with each other now. Mm. So welcome back to the show, Mr. Jackson Stewart.
Hello. There he is. Thank you for having me back.
The director of Beyond the Gates. And we're about to find out something else momentarily.
Yeah.
But before we get there, I can't keep this guy waiting. Also, somebody we've wanted on the show forever. I know Elric's excited.
We've talked about this guy going back to Killer POV how we wanted him on the show.
We're going to shunt tonight. So here, welcome. Brian Usnes with us. Welcome. Hi. How are you?
Abandon all hope, ye who enter.
That's the reference, right?
I guess you've read something.
I just see it clearly.
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us on the show. I mean, it's been really fun. In the last couple of years, some of your films that you directed, like Society, Bride of Reanimator, Return of the Living Dead 3, have all been getting the special edition treatment on Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. It's been great to revisit these films again, see them in the best possible presentation. So
the Society Arrow is brilliant.
Yeah, it's a terrific release.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. So congrats.
Thank God for Arrow, I think.
Yeah.
For you, what was the most exciting one to get a remaster and upgrade?
It was nice to have it done. Hey, I see the finger eye picture there.
That's when we came in with Blum.
That's great because it was a movie that I...
Which one?
Society was very... Yeah. I mean, I was so sure it was going to be number one on the Variety Weekly box office. This is how stupid I was. I totally... disengaged from reality. I just knew it was going to be such a hit. And then even my friends, when they saw it, kind of acted like, you know, it's okay. So it was kind of shocking. It got terrible, kind of scathing reviews, except it did work really well in UK and France.
I was going to say, Elric will tell you, like you are huge in New Zealand.
Well, yeah, because growing up, I always tell people there's no difference between that and Reanimator. They sat on the same place on the shelf, and they were rented equally, so I just thought they're equal movies, and Society pushes it even further. But I met you a while back and was like, before Society was announced, and I remember I was really interested in like why it was so unavailable, and I can't even really recall. So I guess I'm curious again, like what happened to Society after that period?
I didn't own the movie until the early 2000s, and if you make movies and you don't own them, they have to be on the shelf. Figuratively speaking, for them to exist. So you don't have any control, which is the reason you should own something of a movie. So Society was not something I could control. But when I did get it, then I was able to try to kind of, churn it a little bit and get it out there. But it also just had to do with the audience. In the UK, it was a real movie. Yeah. You know, it was a real thing, and it got a lot of attention. But, of course, this is pre-internet time, so you wouldn't know it.
Mm. I wonder if people couldn't get past the gore, and they couldn't even get to the satire because they couldn't see past what they're watching.
I'm not sure, and I also think that sometimes independent movies travel better because foreign audiences tend to be more forgiving for the weaknesses in the movie because they don't recognize it as weakness. They think it's American. So in the
Dudley Warlock is just American.
Well, it's in the same way when we watched J-horror back in that day. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You would look and you'd say, why is she doing that? Yeah. That's stupid.
Oh, it must
and then
just
your friend
Japanese.
Would say, no, no, it's Japanese. No, it's not Japanese. It's actually really stupid. So I think that there's some of that that goes on with independent, low-budget type movies, is that when you do have maybe some dicey acting or, something that isn't maybe, up to snuff, foreign, first of all, they'll dub them with, like, major actors.
Yeah.
So now you have real high quality performances right. where maybe you didn't before. And I think in this country also, right now there's a lot of forgiveness for the 80s.
Yeah, that's true.
So you look back definitely. 30 years and you go, God, that's kind of awkward scene, isn't it? No, it's the 80s.
Everyone was
so great. Microwave massacre, guys.
It's fantastical.
But with society, like one of my friends a couple of years ago for my birthday gave me the Italian Society poster, which is, it's a little strange.
The horror. Society, the horror.
And it's got the psycho house up at the top, and then it's got it kind of these three women that kind of look like they're in a slasher, and then the fourth woman down at the bottom is pulling her own face off. And I don't know what those have to do with each other, but it's a great poster. But yeah, I mean, like, it's a really interesting.
And yet, on the other hand, I was sent a dissertation from the University of Bologna in Italian on society.
That's amazing.
Oh,
wow.
But you knew it was bonkers, because I remember the one thing you said that always struck, because you're also a great producer and working with Stuart so much, but you said something that really stuck with me, this was a while ago, about how you got it made, because that's a hard film to get made, but you said something about, like, because you knew you had the rights to make a Reanimator, that no matter what you did first, you'd get a second chance or something.
Well,
like that.
You know, I never studied film or, you know, I never took a class. I never prepared. And when I started making movies, I just learned by being around. And I did know that, some of the distributors always had a saying. They say, you know, a first-time director usually makes two movies in one with his first movie, his first and his last. And a lot of people get one chance.
Yeah.
And not many people get two. And I thought that if I was going to fail, I wanted to make sure I got two chances. Yeah. And since I had in my pocket the sequel to Reanimator, I made the deal to finance the sequel, but said this has to be a two-picture deal, and that's the second one.
Well, I love that.
So that was
totally 80s negotiation. Yeah. I don't think that happens anymore.
I think it does. I think you can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that just most people don't really want to get into that part of it. And almost, right, especially now, I think more than ever, there's a feeling people want to be an artist. They want to be a director. It's like real important and all this. But they kind of see the financial part of it or the deal part of it as being like, oh, the suits and, you know, somebody in the way of their vision and all this type of thing. And I think that that's totally wrong, personally. And I think that if you don't get involved with that part of it, you're always going to be just at the mercy of the luck of the draw. If you happen to have a good situation, great, but ultimately you have to know what the deals are. And if you want to, you know, hey, you can easily have a bad experience making a movie.
How'd you learn the business side then? Because, I mean, you start, as far as most of us, we would know you as the producer of Reanimator at the time. How did you get to be in that position?
Because I started from that angle, and I read a bunch of books back then about contracts and stuff. And I was pretty ignorant and kind of dumb, you know. Yeah. But I just went into it. And I got involved with the Jason Blum of that era. Or not, he certainly wasn't on Blum's level, the Charlie Band. But he was doing what I wanted to do, which is make a whole bunch of movies like Roger Corman did or Hammer did William Castle. I mean, that's the stuff I loved, and I think we all want to do the stuff that we loved. And Charlie was doing it when I first came out here. I thought, wow, I like that. Well, of course, he was, ethically challenged. Very difficult. But
I like that. I think good. Charlie would own that.
Not pulling any punches.
Well, I always
here.
Remember once they did an article on him, in the calendar, the calendar section of the LA Times, and they said something about... They said, you've been called the Prince of Schlock. What do you have to say about that? And he said, Well, I'd prefer King. And I thought, boy, that is absolutely right.
So you met Stuart through him?
No.
Oh, you knew Stuart before?
No, Charlie didn't have anything to do with Reanimator. I did use his facilities because he owed me money. And so that was a way to balance the books.
That's
and he sold
totally Charlie
it.
Charlie banned of him.
You know, and I gave him the sales rights, but then it took a lawsuit to get him back when the money was forthcoming. But no, Stuart I met through a guy named Bob Greenberg, who was sort of my, sort of the guy who sort of introduced me to the film community in L.A. when I first came out here. And I met him through actually Sally Cruikshank, who was a really super good kind of very kind of author animator, if you ever look her up. And they put she and her husband put me on to Bob Greenberg, who was he was involved in like Dark Star, you know, with the Carpenter thing, and he was involved with, I don't know, I think you can see him in the last shot of History of the World Part 2 or something.
Oh, wow.
In
all
the
right.
Jews in Space one.
Yeah.
And he took me to the set of an Albert Band movie.
Nice.
That was Charlie's father.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then I started getting involved with those guys.
Wow.
And, you know, from there, you know, it's all deals with Charlie. So...
That's amazing.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite special features of all time has to be on Reanimator.
Yeah.
Could have been the Image one, but it's just, it's like an hour-long chat with you and Stuart sitting at a table talking about the whole thing.
Yeah, well,
so candidly, well, and it's one of my favorite special features
before
ever.
Before I touch that, I forgot to answer your question. was that Bob Greenberg was from Chicago, and he said, you know, I lived in North Carolina at that time, and I had put a little one-inch ad in Variety, weekly Variety, that said, horror movie director wanted.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And this is pre-fax machine. I got hundreds of replies, so I started coming out meeting people. And Bob Greenberg at one point said, you know, you should go meet Stuart Gordon. He has a theater company in Chicago. I think you guys should get along. And in... it was at Thanksgiving of 83. I went out to Chicago and saw a couple of his plays, and he was doing stuff with Joe Mantegna and all these like big, you know, he was a real guy. He had been directing theater for 10, 12 years. And I went to see the plays and saw how he dealt with it. We got along, and he had already had a 50-page script for Reanimator for a TV series.
Huh.
And that was, you know, then I said, well, I like that. I'd never read the story, you know, but I said, but then I did, and I said, well, I like that, but it's got to be a feature. And actually, within a year, we were shooting, so we added Dr. Hill. Dr. Hill wasn't in it. It was basically taking it up to Halsey dying.
Well, this is probably like some kind of exclusive here, but can you reveal the other actor that was the very strong runner-up for Herbert West?
Yeah, Miguel Ferrer.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Wow.
Interesting.
So, yeah, people
it's a very
always...
different
It is, and it, you know, it was never in doubt that it was not Jeffrey.
Yeah.
But he was the...
The
lead before Jeffrey came in. And Jeffrey was brought in by Anthony Barneo, who was the casting director. And he, I think Anthony was like managing Jeffrey at that time. I'm not sure. Yeah. But it was never in doubt. I mean, there was never any doubt that when Jeffrey came in, like the Barbara was the second choice for the... for Meg, because the other girl, her mother made her quit.
You know?
In the rehearsals.
Yeah.
And David Gale, I know we had some discussions about it, and I pushed him real hard because I thought that he reminded me of a Hammer guy. And so for me, that's what I wanted to see. I wanted to see that kind of guy. I wanted to see Vincent Price or Peter Cushing. You know, you know, that's what was that in my subconscious. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He definitely had that thing.
But Jeffrey Combs, there was never any, I never remember anybody going, well, let's think about so-and-so. But I do know, but the part was on the page.
Yeah.
I mean, you read the script, right. That part, which Stewart gives credit to William Norris, who's the sort of unsung writer of Reanimator. It's basically Dennis Paoli.
Yeah.
But William Norris was a co-writer, and according to them, you know, Bill Norris was the guy who really caught the
voice.
Who kind of gave the voice to Wes, because if you read the stories, there's no sense of irony there.
Yeah.
No. There's no real... As a matter of fact, I don't think there's much dialogue whatsoever.
No, most of Lovecraft's stories are just kind of stream of conscious.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But anyway, that what you were talking about, that was inspired for me by... because I suggested it to Stuart. We were in Spain, and we were working on Dagon. Mm-hmm. And we were at the post house, and I was trying to get a bunch of extras done for Elite to put out the... I guess it was DVD.
The bright green DVD. Yeah.
So I was really trying to come up with stuff, and I had seen some extras or something on, maybe it was a little featurette on The Exorcist, where Blatty and what's his name?
Friedkin
talked about it.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a good way. You know, instead of these questions, let's just talk about it. And of course, the only unfortunate thing is we only had one camera, so it was
going back and forth.
It would have been great to have two.
Yeah.
But it was great because then it made it more of a, I don't think we had ever talked about it.
It feels like sitting in with friends, hearing you guys talk about it that way, candidly. So, Jackson, what was your into Brian's work? Because I know when you were on our show last time, you talk about like renting 5 videos a week.
Yeah.
And really discovering all these horror titles.
Well,
so.
It's probably the same way everyone else did, where it's like, you know, you start with Reanimator, and then, you know, as you kind of go through the entire filmography of someone like Stuart Gordon or whatever, you start looking at these ancillary people, and Brian's name just kept popping up because they'd worked together all the time. And then I remember I was working at a Hollywood Video back in like 2005, like right out of high school. And one of my friends that worked there, this guy named Leif, was like, you have to watch Society. It's like one of the craziest movies I've ever seen. And I looked at the cover. I was like, what is this, like an art film? And because it had like poster for it was like very misleading for what the movie actually was. It looked like it was like Eating Raoul or something. And then I watched it and I was like, this is like the most disgusting ending I've ever seen in any movie ever. And when I met you at Sitges, I remember that was the first thing I said to you was I shook your hand. I said, you've made the most disgusting ending I've ever seen in any movie ever. And, you know, I mean, Return of Living Dead 3, I guess I saw that beforehand, but it was at a point where, like, I wasn't connecting that these people would, like, make, you know, the same movies or would pop up. And we started watching all these zombie films, but I remember Return of Living Dead 3, watching it after the first one and the second one, I was like, this is such a different tone than what the previous two were. And I thought it was really cool, and I'd never really seen anyone do something like that in a sequel before, where it's like almost in an entirely different subgenre. And I just really liked the way this guy's brain worked. So, you know, and that and like Necronomicon and all these other things just ended up having like a pretty big effect on me. But and you have like so many of these crazy stories and people you've worked with. It's kind of amazing. I just want to keep everything on him because it's super interesting.
Well, I have Necronomicon questions.
Oh, I have a lot, but let's save it.
That's a good example.
Oh, you can go.
Necronomicon. What gives? I want this on Blu-ray.
It's one of my favorite anthologies.
Okay, why?
Honestly.
I'll tell you why. Yeah. Because the people who own it don't care.
Oh.
So it's on the shelf just like Dagon, Beyond Reanimator, Brighter, all these movies that Lionsgate has. They don't have Necronomicon, but they've got a ton of movies that they wouldn't let Scream Factory put out. They don't sub-license like almost everybody else. So that means that they're not out there. And just last year did they put out Return of Living Dead 3, which I know it doesn't have a title, but it's a good zombie movie.
It's great.
Yeah, it's really good.
I loved that one when I was a kid.
And they have The Dentist, mm-hmm. which yeah. with The Dentist 2 is mm-hmm. a nice yeah. two-pack, yeah. you know, and that's a good movie. But they have tons of movies. They just won't put them out. So if you don't have the movie, yeah, you can't do anything with it. And Necronomicon is owned by Metropolitan in France.
Oh, wow.
And you just can't get it from them. You know, you can't. Sammy Hadida, I don't know if you know.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they just won't. They won't. But in France, well, he came out with a nice box with 6 hours of extras because it was Christoph Gans.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't get it here. So that's the mistake. If you're making movies, hang on to some rights so you can put it out, so it exists. And Necronomicon, I know that if I controlled that, it has an audience because it's a weird, it's an experimental movie, and it's just an oddball movie.
Yeah, you
know, but all three stories are great. They're all interesting. Yeah, they're all really the three different directors are all super unique. When we get to yours at the end, it just goes utterly off the rails. It's pretty, but I think it's probably one of my favorite Lovecraft of anything because the stories are all so strange. The first story, you know, really feels like a Lovecraft movie.
Yeah. It's very,
you know?
It seems like the very best Roger Corman Poe.
Exactly.
And the thing that sets you apart, I mean, the thing that attracted me to your work, and the same way Jackson, like where you start to see a voice, is that, you know, you start noticing the use of effects and practical effects and like world and goopiness, like between all your films, you're paying so much attention to that.
This was really interesting because a friend of mine, when I hung out with him the other day, he was like pitching me on, I think it was Silent Night, Deadly Night 5, which I had not seen.
And
he was like, yeah, and he was like, it has that Brian Usna feel. And I was like, oh, that's exactly the thing I'm looking for. So I knew you'd produced it, but it was just one of these things that kind of slipped through the cracks. And, you know, we talked about that on the car ride over. But
didn't that screen recently? And somebody told me that you were just – were you the one who told me, Jackson, or maybe it was you – that you were just going to intro it and not really stick around, but then you watched a few minutes and ended up watching the whole thing.
I never plan to watch those two Silent Night movies again. And I won't go into – there's a good reason why they are the way they are. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of thing that, you know, I don't really want to watch again. And when I couldn't not introduce it.
Right.
Yeah. Because nobody would come. And then I didn't want it, you know, I hated to think, well, I'm the kind of guy that goes, no, I'm not going to introduce that movie. I thought, come on. And there was like a bunch of people there.
Yeah, Christmas Horror has legs.
Yeah.
And then I started watching it. And then I sat down and watched, and I have to say, I hadn't seen it since we made it. And I have to say, I was watching it and going, who the fuck, what are they thinking? Yeah. I was like shocked. I was like really like, this is just too weird.
Well, there's a really kind of inspiring and interesting story with this too, because you gave the script coordinator on Silent Night, Deadly Night 4 the directing job on Part 5.
No, he was actually the script coordinator for the Guyver.
Oh, the Guyver, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's Tarantino's guy, right? I think he's worked on every Tarantino
film. And that's why he got that job, because it was Richard Gladstein is like one of the heroes of Hollywood that you never hear of.
Script supers are the heroes of Hollywood that you never hear of.
And Richard Gladstein he was at Live, and he bought, he got Bride of Reanimator for Live to put out. Mm. And then we got along and he said, hey, let's make some movies. And he said, I bought the rights to this Silent Night stuff and these sequels. And as long as I make them for 700 grand, which is very little back then, today it would be okay.
I was going to say, that's where most horror falls right now.
But on 35 millimeter film.
But that's about half of what it was back then. Yeah. Because
was
you
it
had
a union
film.
Pick?
Yeah. No, there's nothing. I mean, you're talking pretty low end. Mm-hmm. Plus, there had to be a name to it. Mm. So you had to have somebody in it. Mm. And he said, I can do anything I want, you know. And so I said, well, why not? And on the second one, I was producing The Guyver with Screaming Mad George and Steve Wang and great, 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 great suits.
I do love that movie.
And And Richard came out to see the set, to the set. He says, listen, let's do another one of those Silent Night things. And I said, okay, but I said, let's make it Christmas this time. And I said, let's make it about killer toys. And he said, oh, I like that. Let's do that. I said, well, I'll write the script. Let me introduce you to the script supervisor on The Guyver, Martin Kotroser, because I'm telling you, this guy is like really making this work. He's the only one here that knows what's going on. And I had known him before because I had worked with him on a project. I was considering doing his project instead of Reanimator. I was developing it simultaneously. It was a comedy. And so I wrote it with him, the toy maker, and he directed it. And then Richard Gladstein, coincidentally, some months later, he called me up and said, man, he says, I think I've got my ticket out alive. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm going to send you this script. And it was Reservoir Dogs.
Wow.
And so then he said, what do you think? I said, I don't know, pink, white, I don't know. And so all the way through the production, he got Marty to be the script supervisor. Yeah.
And it's got another connection because Monty Hellman directed Silent Night 3 and he was meant to do Reservoir Dogs for a time. So,
I didn't
know
that.
And he ended up being a producer on it.
He's got a producer.
That's weird that there's other weird connections.
But you got to tell him about the that preview screening of Reservoir Dogs.
Because this is before Quentin was like a big shot. I stayed in touch with Richard back then. We worked together a lot. We were really together a lot then. So I went to the rap party and the whole thing. And then he said, man, I don't know about this cut. You know, I really have a thing with the way he wants to, he wasn't in agreement. So would you go look at it? And so we went to the Charles Adikoff screening room, on Sunset, that little one. There's like eight people there. And then right before it started, Tarantino came and said, who are you? What are you doing here? What are you doing? I said, well, Richard asked if I'd come and look. He said, look, man, this is for my friends. Okay, would you just leave?
Whoa.
So my gosh, that's presumptuous.
Well, it was his screening. Yeah. Nobody told him. And then, of course, I told Richard. Richard said, what do you think? And I said, well, I didn't get to see it. The director didn't want me to be there. And he went, what the fuck? Blah, 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 blah. You're telling this. So then they set up a special screening. And this is, of course, Tarantino wasn't the big guy. He was like really polite. Yeah. And then after that, he...
did he not realize who you were the first time?
I am?
I
don't know what you're talking
about.
He's
a big horror fan. Yeah, so I guarantee he had seen Society and Reanimator and all those. Well.
But he did give me a good mention on one of those, they had those Masters of Horror dinners. And I was down at the end of the table and he came in on one of them and sat across from me and we were talking about, I think it was first about Return 3 and then and then something, maybe I said, I remember, you probably don't remember, you kicked me out of the screening.
That's awesome.
And he said, no. He says, it's because of you that I got to get the cut I wanted. Gladstein didn't want it. When you gave it the seal of approval, I got my cut. And so then I got to bask in the glory with all these famous guys for one moment.
Is what it is because of Brian.
Because I didn't give it shade.
Wow, that's great.
Anyway, that's
pretty epic. Before we leave Silent Night, I need that. So part four was actually written to be a Silent Night, Deadly Night? Because I always just assumed it was a witch movie labeled.
But you said something interesting.
That's very complicated.
On the way over, though, because you were like, I should have just made it a Killer Santa movie.
Yeah.
And... I mean, was that ever an idea that they tried to put on you?
It was just that at that time, Screaming Mad George and Woody Keith and myself were just a little out of our minds.
More so than society. And
I just had this idea.
I hear where
you put
it down. I get it.
Yeah, we get it.
Nice.
Well, there was a lot of intention to try to do a lot of what we call simulacra in it.
Uh-huh.
Where you see things two different ways, and we're trying to find a way to do it with moving pictures. Huh. And there's a lot And then there's a lot of like Lilith mythology in there.
Yeah.
So it's really, really, there's a lot of ideas there.
It's the densest of the Silent Night movies.
That, you know, I'm just saying, there's a lot of ideas there that didn't really work on a,
I
on
love
a narrative
trying...
kind of level.
Yeah, yeah.
Simulacra is such like a philosophy thing. I love yeah, that yeah. you were trying to wedge it into Silent Night, yeah. Deadly
no,
Night 4.
I tried to do it with George. We tried it on every movie we did. Huh. We were going to do it with Society.
It works
just
on
got
Society.
Be, yeah, it's very difficult. I think we did a real good one on Progeny. There's there's a shot at the window where the immigration guys kind of become the aliens. Huh. So, you know, I think today you could probably do what we were trying to do with digital, because I think computers can crunch images so much. You might could really make a simulacrum and have it move.
Right.
Which is really what madness is.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, you know, on its simplest level, it's seeing a face in a cloud.
Yeah, yeah.
And on a much more developed level, it's when animals, you know, the back of a beetle looks like a giant face.
Right.
So that the, so there's, and but there's
meanings
a.
Meanings with the meanings and layers.
Well, there's, you know, it's used in nature. But it's also, I think, what happens when you go crazy.
Yeah.
If you
and
watch,
you, huh?
Oh, because I had to do this huge class on simulacra when I was in grad school.
Oh, hey,
no,
how about
the
that?
I used the film Spiral, Uzumaki. It's a Japanese film, and they
Wait,
have
is that the Junji Ito?
Yeah, the Junji Ito graphic novel. If you watch the movie, they do it really well. Where you mentioned the clouds. Mm-hmm. If you go back and rewatch over and over, you actually start to see spiral patterns in the sky from opening frame, but you don't notice it. And then it kind of increases as it goes. But they use it really, really well in that. But yeah, that's like one of the few examples I can think of being
well,
really
here's
executed.
Well, here's a very good example is in Robert Wise's The Haunting. And in The Haunting, if you remember, the big scary scene is when they're in the bedroom and the thing's pounding down the hallway, and they're looking at the door, and the door has some texture in it, and it just keeps watching that texture, and it starts looking like some kind of disturbing countenance, and that's exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't move, but if you can make people feel that, you're starting to get into real fear, real craziness, and sometimes horror is all about showing madness.
It is the reason I think it's hard to translate Philip K. Dick novels to the screen.
Yeah.
Is that because he uses it so much in his books, and it makes it difficult. And even Lovecraft, I think, does it to an extent, because he'll describe rocks, and so you, for like 10 pages, because he liked to write a lot, you're reading about these rocks and how insane and jagged and unexplainable these rocks are, and then you try to put them on screen, and it's a difficult task.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's kind of what Stephen King goes for when he's in his books, when he's has inanimate objects kind of be alive.
Yeah.
But in the films, they never work.
Well, they have like that stingray or something that goes over the hotel in the Shining novel, where it's just this like weird two-dimensional stingray, basically, and it's like on this metaphysical plane, but it's not. It's when you read it, it's a really vivid, odd image. But you're like, how the fuck are you gonna have that not look ridiculous if you film it?
And the answer is you don't, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Do a whole different thing.
Well, I think in a movie, you have to do something. Yeah. You would have to build it from the visuals.
Right.
You can't go from the words. So, and George is very good at that. You know, he could. You know, there's a lot of subtle ways to do it and more, but it takes a tremendous amount of time.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to lock down the camera and get the lighting and so it isn't something to do on a low budget movie.
Well, I wanted to ask you on a business level, you know, talking about some of your endeavors, especially Fantastic Factory, which came about in 2000, number of pictures, all done in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn out of that whole experience? Because I thought that was a really ambitious, cool endeavor that was showcasing a lot of cool talent and a lot of neat stories. You had Faust, Dagon, The Nun.
I learned that I should have had equity in it. I mean, that was great. That was great because, I mean, it was difficult because you were dealing in a country where they didn't have any, they didn't think they could make genre movies.
Right.
And they didn't know the business. They didn't know the independent movie business. And there was also a huge resistance from the established movie makers who were sort of riding a gravy train of subsidies for movies that nobody ever saw or sold or anything. And so their pie is only so big. So when we came in doing that, there was a lot of pushback, and they started going to the, trying to pass laws to, like, if it was in English, you couldn't get any subsidy, you know, all this type of stuff.
Huh.
And, but, what, and the, and you're dealing with a bunch, you're trying to figure out what kind of stories can you tell there, because you're in Spain. And then there's also, you're using all these Spanish actors, and how much can you use the, and let them use their own voice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very,
bus
very...
Bus driver number five.
It's, it's a real, real complicated problem.
Yeah.
But it there was a lot, really great, too. Yeah.
But there was a lot of great Spanish talent that came out of it, too, I feel.
Oh, yeah. But the I had... my label was the Fantastic Factory, and I also helped them set up their foreign sales and stuff.
Right.
And the... and the so my movies were all in English.
Yeah.
I did, I think I did 10 of them. And I tried to get scripts. Nobody would send them to me back then. But honestly, once I went to Spain, it was like, ooh, NBA Europe. Barcelona wasn't even like a capital. Yeah. You know, it's not even like you're going to Paris or Rome. You know, it's like, where? And now it's known. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's very cool now. But there was certainly, I couldn't get scripts. I couldn't get directors to come over. Actors, forget it. You know, you bring an actor from LA to Spain, and boy, they just take, you have to, they're just like babies. You have to take care of everything. So we started going to England, because UK people go to Spain for vacation. It's like going to Mexico. Yeah. And they'll come, they'll fly over for a meeting and go back to London that day. So it was, it's a, there's a lot of very complicated issues. But the great part was, especially at the beginning, I got to choose the movie. I could just choose what I wanted to do.
Right.
But then I had people come that would, that left. They quit because they just couldn't handle. I mean, it's different.
Yeah.
You know,
what
it's
was
really
the,
different.
Out of that slate of films, what was the most gratifying, one that you're happiest with?
I thought that at the time, I thought Dagon was the most the most like complete movie. I just saw it recently, and I mean, I was shocked that it wasn't a big success.
Yeah. Hmm.
But even amongst the genre people I knew, and like I remember the first screening at Sitges, and. And I saw Alan Jones right after. And and I said, isn't that great? And he was like, you know.
That doesn't sound like Alan.
Cranky Alan.
But then again, he loved Roma Santa.
Yeah. What? Really?
Yeah. Huh. And so you look at that. But I think that happens to a lot of people who are critics or festival people, is that they see so much. They're just seeing so many movies. That they just need something that isn't down, you know, that that's different. Or
did the genre people at least embrace it? Because I know we put it on the cover of Fangoria. I wasn't working there at the time, but I know, and we put it in our 101 Horror Films You Need to See book as well.
Yeah. Well, so that's good. But then also you have to have it promoted, and Lionsgate had it, because when we started the Fantastic Factory, I knew. The people at Trimark. So we made a deal with them to pick up the movies, our first slate. And then immediately they sold out to Lionsgate. So then the deal was with Lionsgate. Mm-hmm. And when Lionsgate got these movies, they fobbed them off. They were getting them so cheap, they fobbed them off on the Sci-Fi Channel and made money back. And so they didn't. That was it. Their deal was done.
Well, didn't
so there's the way movies die.
Yeah. You know?
Didn't you like show Dagon to the Weinstein Company or something? Because you had
Dagon.
Yeah, I mean now that they've been properly disgraced, I think you can probably reveal the story. You can
tell stories.
Piss on the grave.
I don't. But we did one movie with Bob Weinstein with Miramax at that Dimension.
That's it.
Which was Darkness.
Well, yes.
Shalma Balagueró.
Yes.
Movie.
Yeah.
You know. So that was
Can you tell the story about the test screening there with
the worst screening of my life?
Oh, now I need to hear.
No, when we cut the movie, when we cut Dagon, not Dagon, Darkness, it was just like we were supposed. They wanted to see a cut, and it was a deal where they didn't get to read the script until they signed. To finance, you know,
great deal,
and then they didn't want to make it. Then there was lots of trouble with the script until that there was like a, it was a SAG strike, so we had to shoot it or before the strike.
Yeah.
So it was all those kinds of things, and on the cut, they couldn't, they could recut it for their territories, which is English language, and of course the budget was bigger than what mm-hmm. we were doing normally. And we weren't ready to, it wasn't finished editing, but they were, you know, just wanted to see it. And the towers had just gone down in New York, so it was just like the next week. It was still smelling in Tribeca. And it was like, no, you got to come. You know, because with Miramax, it was always like, you got to do it right after the towers fell.
People need to see this.
Yeah. And so we were kind of like, well, you know. So I went with Shalma, and we just had like a sync track. I mean, just like a temp track. I don't think we had music. It was just like, well, we'll show it to them. And we're in the Miramax screening room, and then it had all the Miramax, you know, all the people who work there are sitting there. And as the movie's going on, Bob Weinstein's like getting up, going, oh my, he's jumping and going out and coming in getting upset. Ugh. And you're going, oh my God, come here. Wow. It was just terrible. And then we had them recut it. Then I talked Jaume and the editor, who was my big buddy, Luis de la Madrid, who also directed over there. Mm-hmm. And he was like, and I said, listen, we should let them cut it and we should go be a part of it because they can do it anyway. But hey, maybe they got a good idea. We can release it in Spain and internationally, however we want. So just get over the kind of the humiliation of it. And so then all of a sudden we're cutting at Warner's, and the editor for this cut is getting paid more than anybody on the movie. You know? And he starts over from beginning, but he kind of ends up with sort of the same cut.
Wow.
You know? And then but when he showed it, oh man, it had a completely mixed, you know, soundtrack score, and then and timing, and then I thought that's what, you know, I'm used to the low budget stuff where everybody has to kind of like get it, you know, but I thought no, that's not how you do it on a higher level.
Right.
You don't ever show anything unless it's totally finished, and that's another good lesson to learn if you can afford it. You know, don't expect. Oh yeah, they all know about rough cut. They don't. They have no idea.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, test screenings today, they have someone who comes out and goes, everyone understand that this is a work in progress. VFX is not complete.
Which doesn't matter.
They still don't get it.
And then you'll sit in a focus group and the guy goes, yeah, so that thing where the guy died and the makeup looked really fake. And you're like, because the VFX is
complete. But you know, I'm talking about people like Bob Weinstein.
Oh, sure.
I'm talking about people who know better.
Yeah.
But I think that if you aren't involved in that process, I don't think you just can't see somebody else's work without you're not there. Yeah. And I think it really matters. Now, Reanimator, we showed to the Science Fiction Horror and Fantasy Society for our test screening.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, that's
and that was Dr. Donald Reed.
Yes, yeah.
And it was like, you know, back then it was like the rough cut with the tape, you know, untimed, and the and two rolls of sound. Oh, one is the dialogue, man. And one is whatever else you got.
Yeah.
No music, and it still worked.
Yeah, great. That's great.
Well, and this has probably never come out anywhere before, because this was when we were meeting in your office, you told me about this, and this kind of blew my mind. But you were attached to produce the Dylan Dog movie, which ended up becoming Cemetery Man later on with Michele Soavi.
Yeah.
Can you tell them about
that? Well, only because I knew Michele from there was a Dylan Dog festival in Italy that was probably the best horror festival ever.
Yeah. Oh, there's a great.
There were three issues of it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't realize it had quite that fandom. I know the American Dylan Dog, like how it's received here, but it's like huge overseas.
Well, this was a festival.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
And it was based on the comic book,
right,
which was really big. Mm-hmm. And and it was this guy, what's his name? Bonelli. Sergio Bonelli was the publisher of the comic. Mm-hmm. So he put on the festival just to promote the comic. Mm. So anybody who came with the comic got in free.
Wow.
But this was a big basketball arena that they cut in half with a big screen and huge, like, rock and roll concert speakers. And there would be like 1,500 people, you know, or more watching the movies.
Yeah.
And the invitees were behind the screen in the green room, and then every night we would go to his restaurant and eat. It was just great.
That's cool.
Just great. And then Michele Soavi was like, he was coordinating. So then he, so I dealt with him about we were going to do the movie,
yeah,
which I thought turned out real well.
It did.
Oh, God, yeah,
a bit artistic at the end, you know?
Yeah.
But
it
wow.
Works.
Yeah, I think
cool
that
stuff.
The end is actually part of the reasons that I love it, so. Because it does have that art.
Yeah, it's
kind
like a little esoteric.
I love it, yeah. It's a great movie.
I remember reading about the Dylan Dog Fest in Fangoria. I think Tony went out to the convention and he did like a full festival report, and I was like, you know, I was a kid in Connecticut. I was like, I'm going to go out there and check it out. And then it didn't come back.
Yeah.
Well, I think Return of the Living Dead 3 was the last one movie shown.
Really?
Oh, wow.
That's cool. Yeah.
And everything was first class.
Yeah.
Like, everybody flew first class. You could bring friends.
Of course.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's why they never came back.
So great.
Yeah. Exactly. No convention does that. That's crazy.
As curious with, you've directed Jeff playing Herbert West more than even Stuart. Was it weird stepping into that? Was there any resistance when you started directing Reanimator 2 with the actors?
Well, and to piggyback off of that, you had, like, one of the tensest stories, like, leading up to the filming of Bride of Reanimator, I think, just from like a directorial standpoint as far as the actors go,
right.
Which I would love to hear this.
Well, like the Jackson's your conscience.
He's like, you will remember.
He's a prober. No, it's the Bride of Reanimator, once again, it was a deal.
Yeah.
So the Paul White, who was the guy who was financing, like Society, Bride of Reanimator. He had a company called Wild Street Pictures. And he lived he's a UK guy that lived in Japan. And so this was all Japanese money. Those movies were paid 100% by Japanese investors. And on Bride of Reanimator, I was working with Stuart and Dennis on a version of the script. It was like February, and we had this whole version where Herbert West and Dan Cain were like working at a mortuary and I won't go into the details.
Well,
but
there was
a whole story to it, and then the Japanese came and said, well, you know what, you've got to start shooting the first week in June. You have to be in production or the money's gone. So I went to them and said, listen, we got to have a script. I got to shoot in 4 months. And Stuart said, no, I can't do it. We need 6 months for the script, and no way. And so then I paid him off, and I went to the Society guys, Woody Keith and Rick Fry, and I said, listen, we got to come up with a script. And we started with a whole new idea.
Mm.
And on the first day of pre-production, which was May 1st, is when we finally had a script. And we ran it to Kinko's. Yeah, and then, of course, Jeffrey didn't want to do it. He couldn't do it. He wasn't going to be able to. And so then we had to start, like, casting for Herbert West. But then after a couple weeks, he said, okay, I'll do it. You know, I found a hole in my schedule, you know. Uh-huh. And so it was pretty... Who knows?
Can you reveal who you were gonna who the potential?
We were looking at a number of people. One of them was the guy that played Blanchard, and the guy who played Petri in Society. You know, the little prim guy.
Oh, okay, yeah, interesting. Uh-huh.
But we never got that far with it.
Yeah,
I mean, hey, we only had 4 weeks of production.
But he wasn't resistant to you as a director once you guys
Jeffrey,
got rolling? Yeah. Because that must be a big difference because you've got a theater director.
Jeffrey can be very... I've never had a problem with him on set. It's always been tricky with the deals.
Yeah.
That's typical. Some actors can be very difficult on set, but I always kind of feel like it goes with the territory. I'm not one of those people who thinks that actors, what we would consider misbehaving, is somehow, I don't look at it, I don't judge it, because I think that the enterprise of acting, doing it, and then if you are a major player, the pressure of that, I just think it's a bit crazy. It's crazy to be an actor. You're already playing with things about your personality, which are, if you're really getting into it, can be kind of
revealing,
unbalancing. Yeah. Mm. And you are revealing. You're using yourself, and then you have a lot of people standing around judging you. Yeah. And then they stick you somewhere and make you wait 8 hours, 10 hours of boredom, and then hurly rush you, and you've got to do it all right now. And so I've always felt like that it, you know, I don't know if I'm forgiving. It's not up to me to forgive, but I feel like I'm kind of accepting that actors can, I don't ever, when I hear about actors doing crazy things or, they were just so bad, I think, well, you try it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's just something, you know, and you don't usually find it with secondary players. But I also think secondary players don't have the pressure, because they're usually playing kind of one thing, but a lead, and the pressure of it's quite heavy. Mm-hmm. But honestly, with Jeffrey, I've worked with him three times, I think. I never had a problem on set. I always felt like we worked real. I mean, with Beyond Reanimator, imagine we had. We were in Spain, in Valencia, with a whole crew that had no idea what kind of movie we were making. You know what I mean? It's not like here you make it and, you know, hey, on Bridery Animator, my God, we had the Ramones coming to visit. You know what I mean? Everybody wanted to be working on that movie because, you know, and so you just had, it was like everybody on it knew what they were doing. But in Spain... Yeah. They had no idea.
Were you blown away when you saw him? Because you're actually behind me in line, weirdly enough, at Nevermore when it first premiered, where he first played Poe on stage.
Oh, yeah.
I remember just that it blew me away. And where we talk about revealing, like being up there for 2 hours and just going through that, was that impressive to you?
Yeah.
Knowing what he could do?
Yeah, but I know him well enough. Yeah. I know him pretty well. Mm. You know, I spent a lot of time with Jeff. And so I think I know. I mean, I'm very appreciative of him. And especially, I just felt like, I think one of my favorite things, I guess I've worked with him 4 times, I think when he did played Lovecraft on Necronomicon, it's not a big role.
But it was
great because when we were talking about it, I thought, I just kept thinking, you know, the problem is that he's so recognizable. It's just, boom, there's Herbert West or whatever. And it was great that he was, I think, a lot, you know, he was willing to kind of go, yeah, I'll do the prosthetics.
Yeah.
And so we just took Lovecraft's face and gave him the nose and the chin.
Look at all like himself.
And you know what? It was really cool.
Yeah.
Because it really, you know, I don't know if that, I'm sure it changed him a little, because you always hear of stage actors and even early silent actors, they do their own makeup. You know, all they got is their wardrobe and their makeup, you know. I didn't realize that so much when I started, you know, doing movies. I didn't realize how much an actor has so little control.
Yeah.
You give them the lines, you tell them what to do, how to do it, you know, and all they got is like maybe what they're, how they're going to, I'm going to leave this button open, you know. And actors, they put on their makeup, they became, you know, in theater. And so there is something about putting on makeup that makes you somebody, you know.
Yeah, from what I've heard, he loves that. I know he did the Wizard of Gore remake, and I remember talking to the director of that, Jeremy Kasdan, and he's like, did you see Jeffrey Combs? He's like, I didn't know, and I don't know. He's like, oh, he's going to be so happy you said that because we put makeup on him and he's unrecognizable in the role, well, and he just got so into it.
And he had like a big career doing all the Star Trek spinoffs and stuff. It's like the different, you know, Klingons or whatever he was.
But you can't tell him in any of them. Yeah, he was not a Kardashian. Was he a Kardashian?
Yeah, I think he was a Kardashian.
He was a Kardashian.
I know he was blue. In like, in one of the entire series, he was like blue, and he had the thing coming out of his head, like he had antenna and some.
There's another movie I did with directing him. I only directed him in four, I think.
What was the other one you're thinking?
Well, I'm thinking there was Bride, and there was Beyond Reanimator, and there was Necronomicon, and there was he was in Faust, and what else? I don't know.
Well, from Beyond.
But I used when I got the deal in Spain, I called him and Stewart. I called Stewart and I said, hey, listen, I got this deal. I've got these scripts. Which one do you want to do? Pick one. He said, I'll do Dagon. And I called Jeffrey with the first movie, Faust. I says, you be in it. Here, I'm saying, pick a part. He says, well, I never get to be the cop. I said, okay, you get to be the cop.
That's awesome. Very funny.
But you got to swallow a snake. That's the only problem.
With the Guyver, let's talk about the Guyver.
Because I'm a huge,
Dr. East.
And you've got Mark Hamill. And you've got, I mean, like that movie as a budding genre fan who loved both comics and horror, it was just like a perfect combo because you just had monsters and anime and all this stuff. Was that, I mean, like, it was anime first and manga first.
It was manga.
And was that like tough to micromanage in terms of producing and dealing with people who are overseas who own the IP and all that stuff?
I was dealing off of the Society and Brighter Reanimator. I ended up dealing with, I made a lot of movies with the Japanese.
Yeah.
And the great thing about them was they just sent the money. You know?
Nice.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the movies I've done, I've just never had to get anybody to approve anything.
Right.
You know? So that was with Japanese. It was like they would just give you all the money up front. You put it in the bank.
And you see it on screen with the cool suits and the monsters.
But with the Guyver, they asked me to do it.
Yeah.
So it was Screaming Mad George's, he's Japanese. Yeah, it was his project. And he wanted to direct, but he kind of felt like he needed maybe a support. So we got Steve Wang, who was a very big-time effects guy, too.
Yep.
And Steve had done this Super 8 movie called Kung Fu Rascals.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which was really entertaining, you know, really good. And Steve Wang has this incredible ability to do these, you know, there's something about the humor of Kung Fu that I don't get, but I like it when I see it, but I wouldn't have any clue how to catch that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you have to be immersed in it. So then they were directing together, but unlike most people directing together, they didn't work together. So we had to checkerboard the scenes. And so I had two cameras and I had them all, they would be working at the same time, you know. And so the movie is uneven because of that. Because George has his own world that he goes into.
You can see a little
bit of that. And Steve has this really jazzy, kind of funny kind of thing that he does, you know. And it was but the suits, I think, are state of the art. I don't think anything, I mean, Steve had worked on The Predator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you see that in these suits. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, man. I haven't seen any suits like that since.
No, they're super cool.
I mean, I don't know where... Show me. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, those things were great.
Yeah, Steve was also responsible for, I think it was the Gillman and Monster Squad.
Yeah.
So he's just a great sculptor.
Yeah, and he's like, I guess he gets commissioned to do stuff for Guillermo all the time.
Guillermo and various video game companies.
Well, they should have had him do that fish guy in The Shape of Water.
What?
I like the movie, but man, I couldn't stand that character. I just think that's not the way to go with this. Dude, Whenever it was on screen, I was like cringing, you know?
But what about this? It opens up and the penis comes down? Come on. That was all described, I guess.
I was going to say.
Yeah. You never actually got to see that.
Yeah. So, Jackson, can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if you can, but obviously you're working on some new stuff. Are you guys working on something together, or are you just
We're doing Beyond the Gates 2, which is Steve Scarlatta and I are both currently writing that. But that would probably be the next thing. But we just closed... We closed a deal on the next movie for me to direct, which I also worked on with Steve, that Zach Hagen, who produced He Never Died, is producing along with Mike Moran at Mar Vista. That's the company that did Bitch and Corpse Tub and a bunch of other fun stuff. But we closed the deal on that. That's called The Day After Halloween. No connection to Snapshot.
I was going to say.
Uh-oh.
And,
I've got your vinyl already, but no
different
exactly.
movie. So we're just in the process of casting that now, and hopefully should have more stuff to announce on that soon.
So you wrote it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the original script was Steve.
Yeah, yeah, Steve and I came
prior
up with the story
Killer
together.
POV guest.
Yeah. Exactly.
Have we had Steve on Shockwaves?
Not on Shockwaves, on Killer POV. But so, other than the title, is there anything else you can tell us, at least in terms of tone and how it relates to Beyond the Gates?
Well, it's the Day After Halloween's not really connected to Gates in any way, but it's basically like what happens to the final girl after the end of a slasher movie. So it moves into kind of a really weird metaphysical direction that I don't think people would really expect from this type of movie, but it should be fun. So there's that, and then as far as the Beyond the Gates stuff, I mean, Brian and I and Steve have just sort of kicked the tires on that story over and over again, and it's got kind of it's a lot of like inversion on the themes of the first movie, and moves into a sort of medieval RPG element a little bit.
Is this your Army of Darkness, Jackson?
Maybe. Yeah, exactly.
But how did Brian get involved with Gates?
He was just a fan of the first movie, right? Or was that it?
Yeah. So we thought maybe we could help him with some financing and,
Wow. Yeah,
try to help set it up.
Well, we met at Sitges, and I think this was probably like the first time you'd talked to Barbara in probably like 20 years. But I was there with Barbara and our friend Bria, and Barbara introduced me to Brian, and we just all started chatting about this, and it kind of came from there. So it's all if you have a movie in a festival, I highly recommend going to every single one of them, because Zach I actually met on the festival circuit too, and he's getting ready to go into production on He Never Died too. And there's just all sorts of people you end up meeting at these things, and there's nothing to do other than watch movies there and talk to the people who made them. So you end up meeting some very helpful people along the way. So
that's very cool.
Very cool. Congrats.
Thank you.
This can't wrap by any means unless we go into the shunting for a minute. I just want to go into any memories of directing that final, because it's, and talking about Screaming Mad George, because I think artistically his eye for surrealism and your eye for allowing that surrealism to go is like unparalleled. I've never seen anything before or after like that movie. Like those sequences of that movie are one of a kind. So I can only imagine directing that and convincing trained actors, because you've got some good classic actors in this, especially like, is it the mayor or whatever, the key characters like that. Like convincing them to go as goopy as you go. I'm just so fascinated by how that scene, how you're directing that sequence.
Well, didn't it, and just to piggyback on that again, like wasn't part of it, Wasn't it based on the Masturbator, the Dali painting, partially?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big surrealism kind of guy. As a matter of fact, the original poster that we did for From Beyond was based on a Dali painting. Mm. The one with the skulls going into the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
That's a Dali painting. And when I met George for Society, you know, the original script for Society had all the paranoia, had the whole thing, but it wasn't fantastical. It was a blood cult. And it's kind of a memoir of Woody Keith and his fevered imagination. But I wanted to do something that was weirder than that. It had some weird stuff. And when I met George, then we started looking at all his stuff and looking at Dali books. So we just started picking stuff out of the paintings and saying, let's do this and let's do that and let's do this. And then the whole idea, you know, I've kind of gone back in my movie going, and I think subconsciously where that whole idea of the melding came from was from a movie called Dr. X with Faye Ray and I forget who else was in it. And there's one section that's in color, and he's got the synthetic flesh. And I used to have nightmares about that. And that was kind of in a much more cool way. That's sort of the idea of the melding of the shunting. Mm. And plus I always like transformations. That was always my favorite thing in a monster movie is the transformation. And it was like a constant transformation, which actually in From Beyond, the Pretorius guy was supposed to be like the Shoggoth. And he was supposed to be constantly changing. He was never supposed to be just like this. So if you read at the Mountains of Madness, the Shoggoth, when it's coming towards you, it's constantly reconstituting itself. Bones, limbs, things, eyeballs, just
more
as
like
it moves.
Harryhausen effect.
But moving. But of course, all we could do was carve something out of rubber.
Yeah.
You know? So however clever that could be. But with I think with George and with the shunting, we were able to use that kind of gelatin and get stuff that could could kind of meld more.
Yeah. How long did it take to shoot the scene? Because I would plan hours to get into makeup and get back out. Like, how many days was it spread out over?
I think it was 3 or 4 days of the shoot.
And he had to recreate that exact, like, the sinew each time.
Well, the big piece, we only shot in one. I mean, you only make it one time.
You get the orgy once.
Yeah, but you do inserts. Yeah. I mean, that's the way any scene in a movie's done. But they were pieces. There were 13 people under there. Yeah. I mean, this is, in a way, you could think of it as a monster suit for 13 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're all under there. A couple of them had little TVs so they could see. And they're all pushing and pulling and... You know, and
it's like Jabba. You're like doing Jabba the Hutt, basically.
I was going to say, I think at the end of Slither, and James Gunn owes a lot.
It does. Yeah. And why didn't he give me a shout out? I know that guy. Yeah. You know, come on.
But so, like, at no point did any actor raise their hand as you're directing the shunt, just going, what am I doing?
No,
here?
And quite frankly, all the extras were from the crew and friends. Uh-huh.
Wow. You know,
and there were journalists. Chaz Balin's in there.
Of course he did.
You know? Of
course
he did.
Sure, he's in there.
That's
and,
awesome.
And, but everybody wanted to. I mean, in movies, and even the extras.
So amazing.
Everybody wants to do that stuff. I mean, that's movies.
Yeah. You turned a man inside out.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something
I
to
was
be
always
proud of.
They put it on the cover for a while. Yes. So.
I was disappointed because I wanted the slugs to be on the innards.
Oh.
Because I figured while you're doing the shunt, you don't have regular stuff inside you. But I didn't realize how little they would look.
Yeah.
And now I wish I'd done like eels or, you know, something bigger.
Yeah.
You know, you forget in the movies that reality is not the way to go. You've got to. But that was so much fun. I mean, when I was doing that, I just kept thinking, man, this is the life.
Yeah.
You know?
Away with something.
This is just the life, you know? And I think that every now and again on movies. Most on that movie, I never remember any pressure. I just felt like it was purely just a pure ride.
That's awesome.
But most of them, there's a lot of, you know, you end up in the middle of the tunnel, you can't see the other end and stuff. But almost all of them I've done, there's always one point where I go, oh, I know they're going to wonder how I got away with doing this. You know?
So just so people understand my reference, let's start. What was the sign above the shunting stage?
It was abandon hope, all ye who enter
here. He put a sign up above the stage.
Above the shunt.
So as everyone would enter into the shunt, it would say abandon hope. I love that. That's great.
So much. I mean, that was fun. That was pure, pure fun.
I'm just glad people can see it now, because like I remember, I would always tell people about it, but for the longest period, no one could see it.
Well, I think Jackson had the right. He said something that's key, that the art, it opened in England before here because it was financed. The first licensee was Medusa in England. So in the U.S., we released it here with the prints from England, which I then had to, in my garage, cut the bits out that the MPA out of each print. I remember thinking, boy, I'm really in the movie business here. I'm in my garage with every print of the movie, cutting out the frames, going, you really don't have to do this. Nobody's going to go see it, but
I can't imagine the MPAA loving that film.
Oh, first they wanted the whole ending taken out.
Yeah, take the whole thing out. It's like Friedkin tells a great story about Cruising, showing Cruising to them, which is just crazy. And he just said he just filmed, 18 more minutes of stuff, just pornography that he knew he'd never put in the movie, but he knew they would carve. So he front-loaded that to make sure he'd get away with more. I love that. It's just crazy.
I never had that much trouble with him. I always felt like back then you could just go back and forth, and plus it was on film, and they'd have to sit through it again. Mm-hmm. And and it didn't have the sound, and they didn't want to watch it again. Mm. And so you would just mess around a little bit.
Little tweaks.
Yeah, it wasn't that. If I got to deal with them direct, when I got to talk to them, but when it was like, say, on Return of the Living Dead 3, the Trimark talked to them. And so they cut more. Yeah. But I think it was just because
there was
they
didn't
like it.
The self-mutilation thing, too, was like a big hang-up.
Yeah, they
with
took
them,
that
right?
out.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, I wanted to mention is, like, I think Society has one of the coolest sort of stories of, you know, it getting released and then being critically reappraised after, you know, a couple decades, because now everyone looks at it as this, like, socio-political kind of masterpiece, and it's just, you know, we were at dinner on Friday, and Simon Barrett was like, oh, now I just see the shunting and all of these sort of, like, memes and stuff for different, you know, political commentary or whatever, and it's just, it's amazing, like, how kind of pervasive the movie has become in recent years, and certainly with our current president, you know?
Yeah, well, I think in the 80s, it was all greed is good.
Yeah.
And I think that people didn't really, I mean, that wasn't really the point of it anyway. It was just supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's supposed to be a fun kind of take on kind of the way things are. Yeah. You know, it's not like it's some big surprise. That's why I love the ending, that he gets away, but nobody chases him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and you kind of go, why would they chase him?
Yeah.
But he's going to go say, hey, the rich are exploiting us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. It's like, what's going on here? Yeah. You know, but I think in UK, they always like that part of it because they get it. You know, and also in France and in Italy and in Spain, they all kind of liked that. But I think the thing that gives it legs is that those effects, that kind of tone, that kind of way of dealing with I don't know, transformation or something, wasn't seminal. Nobody picked it up. You know, a lot of stuff, you look at, like, the big effect stuff from the 80s, The Thing.
Yeah.
Well, everybody did it. And eventually, you forget why that was impressive. Yeah. I mean, it's still pretty impressive, but you know what I'm saying. Well, but with The Shining, you never saw that again. Yeah. And you won't, because nobody's going to, first of all, there'll never be another person like Screaming Mad George, and those materials, nobody uses them that way anymore. Yeah. You know, and I think that I think when Arrow came out with the box, and I was really, I mean, I had talked to a lot of different companies to put it out, but I went with Arrow because I'd seen one what they did in UK with the Fantastic Factory. They did a box set, which I don't know why nobody else did, because that was the point, was to make it like a Hammer thing.
Yeah.
But then also the they were from UK, and they were just starting up in the US. That was their first release. So I knew when people start, they put a lot into it. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they get it. So they, you don't have to convince them what it is.
Right.
You know, and they don't give the best, they didn't give like the best deal, but it was way better to go with them to make it be what it should be. Mm-hmm. And then the artwork they did, I'm going, now I know what it's going to look like next time.
Yeah,
it's going to be like that.
Because
you know? You could do it too.
Well, is there any chance of anyone like revisiting Society or like a sequel or anything
along
those
lines? Well, you know, I've worked on a sequel, you know, and also I'm trying to work on a TV series, a mini series.
Mm-hmm. I feel like
which I think is where it should go.
You've definitely been contacted about remakes for that, though, right?
Yeah. People contact you all the time. If you've ever been called in because you had a movie that got some attention, you'll find that the meetings are a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all, but it's getting the deal, and a deal that you can live with. If you're willing to just sell something, say, here, take what I have, anybody will do that. And if you, a company owns something, well, they'll make, they'll the howling to death with it. That's what a company does.
Yeah.
But if it's your thing, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you want it to be special because it's all you. You know, it's your thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you want it to be better. It doesn't matter if you do it, but you want it to be better. But the new version that we were working on was takes place like on the late night clubs on Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset. Okay. You know where you have to stand in line.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be on the thing.
Yeah.
Then you got to get into the VIP room. Then you got to get into the VVIP room. Then you got to get into the after party. Then you got to get into upstairs at the after party.
Yeah.
So it's all about exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the main character just wants to be a part of it. So she's ready to give up. She's ready to give up anything.
Yeah. And the club owner is Billy Warlock. 50-year-old Billy Warlock. All right, I'm in.
That was great fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming on board.
Hey,
and coming talk to us. Thank you, Jackson, for setting us up and joining us as well.
It was a blast.
Congrats on the new film. Can't
thank
wait
you.
For it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I mean, celebrate Society.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
It's
with a group shunting.
Yeah, you know, there should be
society parties.
There should be real shunting parties.
There is a shockwave.
Back in the hippie days, we called them Crisco parties.
Gross.
We don't want the Rhonda. We just want a big shunt.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.